Support for Boston Public Radio comes from the Lyric Stage, presenting The Drowsy Chaperone. This bubbly love letter to musical theater includes mix-ups, mayhem, and a wedding or two. Now through May 12th at Lyric Stage Boston. Tickets at lyricstage.com.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, Ambassador Daniel Foote, the U.S. Special Envoy for Haiti, resigned this week, saying he wouldn't be associated with the U.S.'s, quote, inhumane, counterproductive decision to deport thousands of Haitian refugees. Ali Nirani of the National Immigration Forum will join us, and then we'll open up lines to hear what you think about the president's handling of the Haitian crisis at the border. All are welcome, but we'd particularly like to hear from Biden voters.
We'll also be joined by Callie Crossey from WGBH, of course. She'll tell us what she thinks about the Haitian disaster, as well as the Boston mayoral race. Callie says it boils down to a choice between NFH, Wu, as in not from here, Wu, versus the OFD, Asabi George, that's originally from Dorchester, Asabi George. And then she'll give us a sneak preview of what's to come on her Sunday edition of Under the Radar. All that ahead, Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Good morning, Jim. Happy Friday.
And same to you, obviously. How are you?
Good. Thank you.
Good. So the Biden administration obviously is under intense scrutiny and criticism for how they're treating Haitian migrants at the border. Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley says it defies all commitments to the Black Lives Matter movement. Immigration advocates are pointing out how drastically the callous treatment of Haitians at the border contrast with how Afghan refugees are being received, and the total frustration over the situation culminated, as I'm sure you know, in the resignation of Ambassador Daniel Foote, the special envoy for Haiti, who says he will not be associated with the U.S.'s, quote, inhumane decision to deport thousands of Haitian refugees. Join us online to talk about this border crisis and other immigration headlines is Ali Nirani. Ali's the president and CEO of the National Immigration Forum. His forthcoming book is Crossing Borders, The Reconciliation of a Nation of Immigrants. Ali, good to talk to you.
Great to talk to you all as well.
Yeah, thank you very much for joining us, Ali. So I don't understand. President Biden, who talked about trying to fix immigration, now seems to be doubling down on what he's doing with the Haitian refugees. I'm reading reports that he's doubled the number of people he's deporting. He seems like more like Donald Trump than the Joe Biden I think a lot of us expected. So why is he doing this?
You know, I think that the Biden administration feels like they're between a rock and a hard place right now. They feel like that, you know, the only way to convince the country that there's control at the border is to ramp up deportations. They're not even deportations, they're removals of Haitians from Del Rio to Haiti. And then the other side of this is that you have progressive activists saying, okay, what the heck is going on here? You know, look, this is going to keep going on and on and on. The Wall Street Journal had an amazing story this morning that actually dug really deep into just the growing migration to the U.S. from across Latin and South America. So our thinking here is that unless the Biden administration, number one, rallies the international community to think about migration in a very different way, engage the UN, engage the countries throughout the region, number two, be serious about finding a legislative compromise in Congress between Republicans and Democrats, this is just going to continue to replay week after week, month after month. And, you know, what we've seen over the last week in Texas and in Haiti is just, it's just awful.
Well, first of all, the legislature is not about to do anything about immigration anytime soon. The Senate parliamentarian and the Democrats made clear, the Republicans, that's not going to happen. I want to focus, though, on what Marjorie said. She sort of blew past the Trump thing. My understanding is he's using this Article 42, he, Biden, this public health pandemic thing that allows him to bypass what would normally be the asylum process. And I want to quote, we're going to talk to Callie Crossey later about the head of the NAACP, who said it perfectly. If Trump were doing this, every single Democrat in America would be saying this is one of the most grotesque, racist acts ever. And I have to say, as a non-immigration expert, Ali, I would agree. This is unbelievable. And, you know, the fact that they're not going to use the horses anymore, great. The fact of the matter is that image, I think, is emblazoned not just on the body of a Haitian, but on the minds of everybody in this country and world, no?
You're absolutely right. I mean, after Trump, but even after Obama tried to use in many ways the same deterrence through deportation strategy to enforcing the border, it failed during the Obama administration. It failed during the Trump administration. And now what we're seeing is a deeply inhumane approach to Haitian migrants at the border. And, you know, this is the challenge of this. Like, we are focused right now on Haitian migrants. This has been happening in different ways at the border since Trump, since Obama, before.
You know, one of the things I don't understand is not everybody is being flown out. And by the way, when they get back to Port-au-Prince, which is not the friendliest place, some of them left after the earthquake 11 years ago, have no family, have no home, and they're given $100 and sent on their way.
And no shelter.
What I don't understand is, how is the administration deciding who is allowed to stay here and apply for asylum and who gets shipped back? Willy-nilly, it seems to me.
So there's been absolutely no transparency into the process they've used. The best that we can tell is that single adults who are you know, presenting themselves to ask for asylum, they are turned around through Title 42. That's the way that Central Americans and others are being treated. Families with children of, quote, a tender age, typically between under 5 or 7 years old, they, if they have a what is seen as a potential asylum claim, they're being released into the country with notices to appear at an immigration court within 60 days. I was actually in Del Rio earlier this week, and I talked to some of the folks who were there who are helping people at a respite center. And they were, you know, it's amazing what's happening in Del Rio. Del Rio is a town of like 35,000 people. At the border were literally 10,000 Haitians, right? So people in Del Rio, small community organizations, were providing some sort of respite so that when these families were released, they could find a bus, figure out where their families were in the States, and figure out, in essence, how to get from Del Rio, which is kind of the middle of nowhere, Texas, to someplace in the interior so they can make a court date. It's a failure at so many levels. It's really just staggering.
We're talking with Ali Narani from the National Immigration Forum. Ali, you touched on something before about how this is going to keep happening. And it's not just going to keep happening because of governments falling apart and gangs and all this. I mean, we're reading on the other side of the world now about people, mass starvation in Ethiopia, you know, that has to do with a lot of problems there. But my point is, because of climate change, it's going to be happening pretty soon from all these places around the world where people can't eat, where their towns are underwater, where there's a constant drought or whatever it's going to be. And it seems like we're still talking about, well, if we just, you know, get rid of the corruption or we have a better government in Haiti or whatever, then people aren't going to come here. But that, I think that we're missing the bigger picture.
So, you know, this book that I have coming out next year, one of the things that I actually found as I was doing the research, the Syrian war, it was started because, to a large degree, because of a drought in rural Syria that triggered a protest from farmers that Assad overreacted to, created this massive civil war, and then 3-5 million Syrians pouring into Europe and around the world. This is the situation that is playing out over and over again. And that's why I just think that, you know, developed countries, international institutions have got to come to terms not only with climate change, but with the fact that people are going to migrate. And how do you manage that migration? Because you can't deport somebody. You can't enforce your way out of this problem. If that isn't clear by now, I'm not entirely sure what else is going
to
make it clear.
So while we're waiting for people in Congress to act like grownups and treat fellow human beings like human beings, what should Biden have done here to have without the big fix? Without what should he have done to avoid this horror?
Well, first of all, this should not have been a surprise. There has been reporting for the last 6 months about Haitian migrants and other migrants moving from South America up into Mexico into the U.S. You know, the Darien Gap in Panama is this very, it's a jungle that people are literally going through in order to make this trip. There's been a ton of reporting on this. And what the Biden administration has tried to do is pressure Mexico to enforce their southern border, in essence, to try to stop this flow. That has failed. So this is what I think the Biden administration should have done. Number one, work with Mexico to stand up an asylum and refugee program in the region so that people can apply for legal status in Mexico. Mm-hmm. Number two, put in place in a much faster pace than what they've done are the refugee programs that they talked about a few months ago in Central America, so people could apply for protection. That would at least help families apply for protection there, as opposed to trying to traverse to Mexico. And number three, the Biden administration has flexibility with the H-2B program. This is the program for tourism industry and other kind of service sector and light manufacturing.
It's like all those really summer workers on Cape Cod, actually, that we see precisely. All the time. Yeah, yeah. And do what with
so
that?
So they could increase that, the number of visas there.
I see.
It's really kind of one of the only visa programs that the executive branch has control over in terms of numbers. So those are three things that they could have done.
But I don't mean to, I was going to say beat this dead horse with a horrible choice of words at this particular time. In light of the fact they hadn't done those things, even if they said when they saw 10, 15,000 Haitian migrants in Del Rio, that's what we should have done and should do now, what should they have done when all these Haitians appeared and they hadn't done the preventive, for lack of a better expression, things, Ali Narani, that you're prescribing short of just mass deportation? Was there an alternative?
So number one, World Central Kitchen for the first time worked with the Department of Homeland Security to provide food at the site.
Really? I didn't know that.
Which is wonderful, right? Which is great. On the other hand, it's the federal government. You should have been able to deploy the National Guard and other infrastructure to provide people food and shelter. Second, the administration really needs to surge the personnel, immigration judges, asylum officers, and others to the border. You know, I cannot, as much as I do not want people to be sent back to Haiti, a nation that is much worse off than when they left, I also can't sit here and say that everybody who applies for asylum should be able to get asylum.
Of course.
Right. So the folks that need to be returned, instead of sending them back to Haiti, what about setting up some sort of settlement with Chile or other countries in South America that a lot of these folks actually came from, you know, in the last 10 years?
You know, big picture, I'm just wondering if you know, Ali Narani, what it's like around the world. We heard, you know, the people coming over in boats to Italy and the Pope being down there trying to welcome them years ago. And, you know, early in when he became the Pope, we hear about in France, the friction between the French and the Muslims that are coming in and the difficulties for Muslims getting jobs. Is there jobs? Just to get away from our southern border for a second, what is the big picture of refugees around the world? And, well, that's a kind of a ridiculous question. The world is too big, I guess. But what is happening?
Yeah. So it's a really, really important question, Marjorie, because what's happening is that nations are externalizing their borders. This first happened in the last 10, 15 years, at least, when Viktor Orban at Hungary said, okay, I'm going to start to harden our border, the external European Union border in Hungary. And then Turkey did the same thing. Now what's happening, in fact, there's a CBS News piece, I think, that ran last night, that Afghan refugees who are trying to get out of Afghanistan across Iran to Europe are hitting border walls and in border infrastructure in Turkey.
Yep.
So the EU is spending money to push their border further and further away from actually their border, if you will. And that is really, at the end of the day, pinning migrants up against, you know, in places that are at best unwelcoming, at worst outright hostile. The U.S. is doing the same thing. You know, we are pressuring Mexico to harden their southern border in many of the same ways. So, you know, again, we're trying to manage the perfectly rational decision that somebody will make to pursue a better life through enforcement. And that's not a sustainable solution.
We're talking to Ali Narani, National Immigration Forum. You know, I said in the introduction to this, and I assume it was news to nobody, is the contrast between how most of this country is treating Afghan refugees as compared to Haitian migrants here is just, it couldn't be more stark. We have this wonderful story in I think it's the Springfield newspaper, the Springfield Republican, about how a bunch of organizations, including Jewish organizations, are greeting 400-plus Afghans in Western Mass. Charlie Baker was with us last week, spoke to the welcome that all of Massachusetts intends to give. Is that fairly uniform? Let's not talk about the Republican Congress people. I can't handle that this early in the morning. In terms of the American people, has there generally been a pretty decent welcome throughout the country, Ellie?
You know, it's pretty remarkable. Across the country, in fact, every day, you know, we put out this daily newsletter that pulls immigration clips from across the country. Yep. And ever since the Afghan refugee crisis emerged, we've been running or kind of posting, you know, a handful of local stories. And I think this morning's note includes stories from, you know, Texas, Iowa. So there are communities all across the country who are, you know, providing cars, organizing interpreters, donating significant amounts of money. There's a group of Mormon women, in fact, that's in Texas who were helping Afghan refugees every week because they felt it was the right and the important thing to do. Now, the question is, okay, how do you take that deep support for Afghan refugees and expand it to other populations? And that's not going to be easy because people, you know, if it was easy, you know, it would be done. I really do think that if Americans can have a good experience on the resettlement of Afghan refugees, hopefully they'll look at whether it's Haitians or Hondurans or Mexicans or Chinese who are looking for protection here in the U.S. in a different way.
Well, do a poll recently that suggests that there's pretty broad support for that notion that does go beyond Afghans? Can you share that with people?
Yeah, sure. So we just released a poll. The sample size was about 1,200 adults, including 1,000 registered voters, and 65% of Americans overall agreed that the U.S. should have a legal, secure process in place to take in people from oppressed or war-torn countries such as Afghanistan. So we put in the "such as" to get a sense of, okay, where people are now, but then see if it could be expanded. 65% overall, including 61% of Republicans, 63% of Independents, and 75% of Democrats. The fact that you have 61% of Republicans saying this is the right thing to do, I think, again, kind of gives us an opportunity to begin to shift this conversation.
But I hate to be so cynical, but I wonder if a lot of that has to do with Americans' fondness for the military and the idea that the Army and the Marines and all the people were helped over there in Afghanistan by Afghanis, and that makes it different. You know, obviously Haitians are black, and we have a big race problem in the country. So it almost seems like it's two different baskets.
You know, I completely agree with you. It is different, and for all the reasons you lay out, Marjorie. But you know, I gotta say, as you know, for someone who's worked in immigration far too long for one's mental health, this is.
I do wonder, Allie, how you do what you do day after day and not be just a basket case when we talk to you.
But
I'm sorry
he is.
To interrupt.
But go ahead, Allie.
I have never seen this kind of support for the resettlement of any community in the United States. So, I mean, 65% or 61% of Republicans, and that's dipped just a little bit, you know, from late summer. So, you know, our kind of unofficial motto as an organization is, okay, let's meet people where they are, but let's not leave them there. So that's why, and I don't want to dismiss the awfulness of what we're seeing at the U.S.-Mexico border and the terrible way that Haitians are being treated here. Because it speaks to the original sin of our nation, absolutely. But, you know, I think we also just have to realize that folks are really grappling with, you know, this idea of immigration to the United States. So let's take something that they feel good about, make sure that they have a good experience, and then work like heck to expand that understanding of the value of immigrants and immigration.
Marjorie wants to end with a wonderful story, but before we do, you mentioned this note you send out every day. Marjorie and I get it, but for those who would like to get it, how do they sign up for that, Ellie?
Thank you. So you go to immigrationforum.org and you sign up for updates. And the note itself is called Narani's Notes. It's a tragically named newsletter, but people seem to like the content.
So Ali Narani, anybody who spent time in an assisted living place or in a nursing home with loved ones or whatever notices that, a lot of the people that are taking such care, good care of their loved ones are people that didn't come from the United States of America. And there's a great piece in the Washington Post about this group of people, these retirees at a place called Goodwin House, where a lot of the people, or at least some of the people, are from the Sierra Leone. Tell us about, and also, I should say, Haiti and Jamaica and Cameroon. They're mostly black people. And tell us about what's going on with these people in the Goodwin House.
Yeah, it is just a fantastic story. So like you said, Marjorie, the Goodwin House is an assisted living center in Northern Virginia. And what happened is that the residents realized that, you know, a lot of the folks that were helping them on a day-to-day basis had yet to become citizens. And, you know, there's a quote here, and one of the residents was, quote, shocked when she read that the path to citizenship was becoming even more difficult because of fee increases. So what they did is that they banded together to raise money. I think they raised about $40,000 from residents to help pay for the naturalization fees. But then even more than that, they helped the staff from all these amazing countries, you know, learn English, brush up on their civics so they get past the citizenship test. And, you know, again, this is kind of just, it's one of those examples where someone has a personal relationship, a personal interaction with someone who's an immigrant or refugee and says, you know what, I can help here. This is the right thing to do for me because they're helping me, but it's also the right thing to do for them. And they're just, I mean, this is a beautiful story. And, you know, there's just beautiful stories like this all across the country.
They raise $40,000, as you say. They help them prepare for the exam. Well, I mean, it's just.
And they also talked about how the filing fee has dramatically increased in cost. It was $95 in 1994. Yeah. Then it went to $640 in 2016. Then the Trump administration raised it to $1,170. Apparently now a judge put it back to $725. But that's still an awful lot of money if you're somebody that's kind of, you know, down to C's and stems because you don't have
money.
It is an awful lot of money. And they also point out in this story, which is so true, you know, I just said to Jim, this is really embarrassing. When I was in college, I wrote my graduation thesis on the Federalist Papers. And one of the questions is, who wrote the Federalist Papers? I said, well, I know Alexander Hamilton wrote the Federalist Papers. Who was the other guy? I mean, I thought, I wrote my thesis on this. I went to Stanford University. These people are supposed to know all about the Federalist Papers that just got here. I mean, the citizenship test, as the story points out, is something most Americans would flunk. I mean,
yeah. You know, there's another piece of this that I wanted to talk to for a second is that the fact that this all took place, you know, at somebody's work site, it also improves access to the process. So, you know, we do work with corporations across the country. And what we encourage them to do is, you know, help people go through the naturalization process, study for the naturalization test at the work site and provide that access there because, you know, all of our lives are busy. And, you know, so the fee is certainly one barrier to access to citizenship. But just the other piece is just the actual, you know, being able to sit down and study for that civics test, go through the application. All those kinds of things are just they have a real life impact on people's lives.
By the way, since I looked it up, there are three people who wrote the Federalist Papers.
There were.
Yes. John Jay and James Mass, in addition to Alexander Hamilton.
I knew that.
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Okay.
Ellie, we really appreciate your time, as always. Thanks so much.
Thank
Looking
you.
Forward to the book, too.
Yeah.
We should talk about that
Thank
soon.
You very
Thanks.
Much. And I do hope you take care of your mental health, Ellie, because you're somebody that really needs it, I think. Not because of the way you talk to us, but just what you're doing. It's very difficult work, and thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Really, it's always great to talk to you.
Ali Narani joins us regularly. He's the president and CEO of the National Immigration Forum. His forthcoming book is Crossing Borders, The Reconciliation of a Nation of Immigrants. Ali Narani, great to talk to you. Thank you so much for joining us. Coming up, we're going to open the lines at 877-301-8970 and ask you about what we've just been talking about with Ali Narani. What should the Biden administration be doing at the southern border? If Biden were Donald Trump, in treating these immigrants the way Joe Biden has just treated them, would the nation be up in arms about this? People that did not like Donald Trump, is the media being biased here, treating this differently than if Donald Trump were the president? What should we be doing about this crisis at the southern border. 877-301-8970, bprwgbh.org, or you can tweet us at Boss Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brody and Marjorie Egan. President Trump outraged the world when he said, why take immigrants from asshole nations? Haiti, as I'm sure you remember, was one of the nations he was referring to. Looking at today's border crisis, is Biden's attitude towards Haitians really that different from Trump's? During the 2020 campaign, Biden promised his administration would have a more humane immigration policy than Trump's. And yet the mass deportations and the images, those incredible images of men on horseback chasing black asylum seekers, looks a lot like Trump-era policy. So we're opening the lines asking, particularly Biden supporters, obviously anybody's welcome, but particularly Biden voters, where are you on this? Are you disappointed in the president? Do you think immigration will never be an issue that any president can get right? Do you agree with Biden's critics who are saying this is a racist response to the border crisis? 877-301-8970. And let me answer part of what you said in your tease to this segment, Marjorie. You were saying is the media, which obviously leans liberal, even though I think most of the reporting in the mainstream media is down the middle, have they shown a bias towards Biden? Here's the headline from Axios. New York Times compares Biden to Trump, and they pick a couple of examples here. They have a quote from Marissa Franco, who is the executive director of a Latino civil rights organization. The question that's being asked now, how are you actually different than Trump? Frank Bruni writes, he pulled out of Afghanistan without the degree of consultation, coordination, competence that allies expected, at least of any American president not named Trump. And Biden's return of hundreds, actually thousands, of desperate Haitian migrants to Haiti also seems Trumpy to many observers. So I think most of the press has played this as it is, which is an incredible policy that I'm not saying he is racist, but the policy sure as hell seems to be.
Well, I mean, it's hard to look at pictures of white men on horseback chasing black men who don't even have shoes on and are in the water and think that they would be. I just don't see them doing that to a bunch of blonde women or little girls. You know what I mean?
You know, also, we asked Ali Nirani, who's an expert in this, you know, what could he have done differently? And neither, I'll play Marjorie again, I'm not an expert in immigration policy. I don't know what he could have done differently. I respect and trust what Ali said. But that's not really the issue. That's his job. I mean, that's their job in the administration. Saying how they didn't get it right doesn't mean we have an obligation to explain how he should have done it. I can just say this is not how he should have done it. And then he appeared, at least in the early reports I read, once he got criticism, including from some high-ranking fellow Democrats, particularly black fellow Democrats, he doubles down on this. Am I not right that they picked up the pace of the deportations even after the initial photographs, the ones you described? Didn't he pick up the pace?
Well, one of these stories I read this morning from the Washington Post talked about how there are plans to remove even more people and send them back to Haiti. Well, you know, Obama was known as the deporter in chief by many people who were advocating different immigration policies. And, you know, there was the big fight about keeping kids in cages. That was not happening to the degree under Obama that it was under Trump. I mean, they were moving them much faster under Obama than Trump, who kept kids there for a long time. But in any case, you know, this is not going to go away. I, as I was saying to Narayan, I'm not obviously an expert either, but this is going to become a bigger problem, not just with countries that are a mess politically and economically, but with countries that are done in by climate change. It's just going to get worse and worse and worse.
You know, the truest thing, though, that has been said by any of the observers, and I just read that quote from that Marissa Franco, is if Trump had done this, if we had seen the same images, those horse images under a Trump administration, there was mass deportation of Haitian migrants, people, Democrats, liberals, and by the way, a lot of them, to their credit, are calling this exactly as it is, I should say, but I think they all should be doing that. 877-301-8970. Let's start in Braintree with Paul. Welcome to the show. Hi.
Hi, Jim. How are you, Marjorie?
Good.
I have a solution. Sure. I doubt it, but let's try.
Okay.
But first, have any of you done a genealogical study of your heritage?
No.
I have.
Mm-hmm.
And what shows up is the migration. I'm of Italian descent, but the migration that came from Central Europe, this is 1,000 years ago, before nation states were formed. So migration is something genetic, perhaps, in human nature. I don't think it's going to stop. Just historically, looking at that, I was amazed at at the migration, if they're correct, and you know they have more knowledge than I do, that migration in and of itself is part of human nature. That's not going to change. A quick.
But wait, how is that a solution? Understanding history and
it isn't.
Even okay, go ahead.
It isn't a solution. It's just a fact, I think, of migration of human beings from the beginning of time, and I don't think it's going to stop. One question I have is, why didn't the president knock on the door of Jamaica, which is the other side of the island of Haiti, to have them accept?
So it's the Dominican Republic, yeah. I assume you mean. Yeah.
What's that?
Dominican you mean the Dominican Republic.
Republic. Excuse me, Dominican Republic, of course, which is prosperous. And,
I have no idea.
Or Jamaica, too. But why haven't they knocked on the door of the Dominican Republic? Thank you. I didn't do well in geography.
I don't think the Dominican Republic is prosperous either. You know,
I think comparatively speaking,
Speaking, well, but when you go by, when you go there, that was one of the most horrific things about going to one of those resorts that I went to once in the Dominican Republic. The poverty I passed.
You're like you're gated away from.
Paul.
The bottom line, if you want to gauge on the prosperous scale, they're not going to hold a candle to us. And so, and again, I'm not saying, and thank you for your call and your historical analysis there. I'm not saying that any of these solutions are easy, but the notion, I called it Article 42, it's Title 42. The fact that we are using this pandemic provision that was created by Trump to deny people who otherwise would be allowed to apply for asylum is unbelievable to me. And it's just... And again, it'd be a real problem. What do we do with the 18,000? Well, you know, Ali said we should try to strike a deal with one of the other countries, maybe Mexico, so there can be some joint obligation. I don't know what it is, but the bottom line is, as I say, all we know is this was not the solution. Let's go to Newton. Billy, welcome. Hi.
Hey, guys. Big fan of the show.
Thanks.
Good to be with you. Yes. So my parents immigrated here from Haiti in the late 60s. And so this experience has been, you know, really tough for those of us who are of Haitian-American descent to witness. In terms of the solutions, I'd like to see more possible sponsorships. I mean, there's tons of thriving, you know, Haitian-American environments and communities in the United States that would be more than willing to participate in the process. I know the laws, you know, right now wouldn't change, but I'd like to see more, you know, partnerships with those willing to be of some type of aid in the issue.
Well, you know, it's interesting you say that, as we mentioned just in passing, the welcome that Afghan refugees are getting. Community after community after community is not just, you know, rhetorically welcoming people from Afghanistan, but providing for them as well. And so I don't think it has to be limited to just concentration of Haitian Americans. Like, isn't Greater Boston the third highest concentration, I think, of Haitian Americans in the country?
John
the
Barris, reality is, just, no, he's Cape Verdean.
Yeah,
he's Cape
people Verdean, who care about human beings, Billy, beyond Haitian Americans here, should be willing to be part of the solution, don't you think?
I completely agree. You know, maybe it's a far-fetched for some, but
of course,
we need to start somewhere.
Billy, thank you for your call.
Hey, Billy, before you go, are your parents still with us? Are they still around?
No, they've passed.
They passed because I wondered for people that came from Haiti what their reaction was. But thank you very much.
You know, the other thing I mentioned just briefly to Ali when we were talking to him a couple of minutes ago. How do you like this fact? We dump them off the plane in one of the most dangerous spots in Port-au-Prince. As I said to Ali recently, you know, just a few minutes ago, a lot of them haven't been to Haiti in 11 years, so have no family, no shelter, as you said, et cetera. And we give them $100, and that's supposed to assuage our guilt or satisfy our obligation. If we're going to deport them, doesn't there need to be some plan for them to have lives that are safe and are safe?
Well, they also talk about things being that there's so much murder and rape and armed gangs, and that the Americans that are living there are living basically in armed, guarded, little behind closed doors kind of operations.
Right, we need to be protected there, but we can drop them off with $100 and say good luck.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, especially people that haven't been there for years. Derek in New Hampshire, thank you for calling.
Hi, Derek.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I don't think it's necessarily an apples-to-apples comparison between, you know, the Trump doubling down on the Obama policy of taking children from their mm-hmm. parents, right? The cruelty was the point of it. I think that this just further displays the amount of abject racism within our, you know, law enforcement community. And it's, you know, it's just more displays of the inequities in our culture and just how we can easily subhumanize anybody. You know, like, it doesn't have to necessarily be minorities always, but they're a very easy scapegoat. But poor people are the same thing. I mean, look at the Gabby Petito
situation,
right?
Exactly.
And it's spurred so much conversation, but the fact of the matter is it's just all glaring inequities that just continue to, you know, hit us in every way because, you know, we're just unwilling to reckon with our past and what is our current present.
I think it's true. I'm not suggesting that what was in Donald Trump's heart is what's in Biden's heart, but his behavior here, Derek, is not much different from how Donald Trump handled comparable situations.
He didn't send those the Border Patrol guys there and tell them to corral those.
No,
people.
His administration. Like, but wait, his administration chose to deport them en masse, though. That wasn't the BPD making that decision.
Well, it's a difficult situation. You got 15,000 people streaming there. I'm not saying that they should have done what they did, but I think to like say that he's like an abject racist and he's upholding these.
I didn't say he was an abject racist.
Well, you did say that he's upholding abject racist policies, and therefore, by proximity, he is.
Do you think, Derek, if, as Marjorie said before, if these were getting back to the Gabrielle Petito case, do you think if these were 1,000 white migrants, he'd be shipping them back by the thousands on planes? I don't.
It would depend on their. It would all depend on their economic standing, okay. Right? I mean, if they were Russians that were trying to infiltrate mm-hmm. our border. Then,
well,
yeah, I would treat them the exact same way.
I mean, if they were similarly situated,
if they were poor people, period, I think that we would be treating them the same way that couldn't speak
Maybe.
English.
I respect your opinion, Derek, but I respectfully disagree. I'm not saying Biden's an abject racist. I am saying I think the behavior is racist.
Two things. I remember, I think the first person I ever heard say it was Ayanna Pressley, the congresswoman,
yeah.
who said with Trump, cruelty is the point.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is...
That was Derek's point, too.
Yes,
yeah.
That is a legitimate difference in terms of between the two men. And I also think back to Bill Clinton and Bosnia, Croatia. You know, there are a lot of little blondes running around over mm-hmm. there. I think that was the rapes and the murders that we were witnessing over there, I think, got a different response from the United States and enabled Bill Clinton to go over there and intervene.
Do you know how many people, by the way, I don't want to get off on a sidetrack, are looking for this laundry guy now?
You should mention, 70-plus
law enforcement people.
Derek, talking about Gabby Petito, you did a great segment on this.
Well,
about your show
I assume
last
everyone
night.
Knows about this. You know, the great line from Gwen Ifill, missing white woman syndrome. Many, many people, I talked about it last night, but surely not original to me. Many people are saying that we only care about missing women when they're white women, particularly white attractive women. And the point was made, I had a woman
white,
who's a leader of an
young,
indigenous peoples organization last night, and her body was found in Wyoming. Over a decade in Wyoming, there were 710 missing indigenous women and girls. Do you know about any of their cases? Do you know about any of the cases the end of last year? 13,000 black women and girls, by the way, well in excess of their percentage of the population. You know about those cases?
No.
I mean, that's the other point Derek was making, and I think it was a good one. Bernadette, hi.
Oh, hi. I liked that the gentleman just before me, I agree with him.
Derek, yeah.
And I think that the real problem, as I see it, is the border control. They're just a racist pack of white supremacists. And every now and then you get someone, I heard someone on GBH yesterday who was a whistleblower, and she was talking about the culture of that. So there's just such a systemic problem there that it doesn't matter who the president is. It feels like it's all out of control. And secondly, Texas, you have to lay a little blame at Texas's feet because they encourage that kind of thought in that state more and more. And I think that they're out of control.
That's well, you know, Bernadette, let me just say, all I know is anecdotal stuff. Obviously, how you describe the guy on the horse is totally appropriate. I've heard and read in recent months lots of stories about Border Patrol people who've gone out of their way in the most humane kinds of way to provide help to the migrants with whom they're dealing. There was video on CNN last night of a guy, a Haitian guy, who was getting washed away. Is it the Rio Grande? What's the river there? Is it the Rio Grande? I should know. I'm embarrassed.
Think so.
Whatever the river is.
I'm not sure either.
And thank you, Chelsea. It is the Rio Grande. They threw him a lifeline. I mean, of course, you should say, what's the big deal? Well, they saved his life. And so, I'm not suggesting there's not some horrible souls in that group, including that one character. But I think a lot of them have incredibly hard jobs, and some of them actually care deeply about the people they're charged with.
Yeah. Push back of
course you
tiny
can.
Bit.
Of course you can.
Great, because I listen to GBH all the time, and I've heard story after story over years about the border control, and the fact that you're pointing out the, you know, throwing someone a lifeline, my God. That's what
of course you should do it, but it's in contrast to not, riding a horse and using the reins to whip somebody. What? I'm sorry.
Right. But so that shouldn't be the news.
You're right. You're totally right. You're totally right.
It tells me exactly that what I'm saying and what I've been listening to in news reports for years about the border control is true. And that's the problem.
I got it. I got it.
It's corrupt.
Now, you guys, I hear your point. By the way, what I was referencing, and I can't think of the guy's name, is a Latino writer who was being interviewed on NPR. I heard him a weekend or so ago, wrote a book, actually, about he went to the border with all of the preconceptions that many of us have about sort of the broad brush preconceptions. And he said he came away after he had met with and worked with and observed a number of the Border Patrol people that was far better than what you and I, Bernadette, came in with. But I respect your opinion, too. Thanks for the call. We appreciate it.
I'm getting some emails from people who either
Francisco Cantu, Chelsea tells me yet again, and I believe that may have been him. That is right, I think.
I'm getting emails from people who either lived or visited the Dominican Republic, who actually lives there now 3 months of the year, and talking about the discrimination against Haitians in the Dominican Republic. Right. And that there are marginalized groups, as Judith who are regularly discriminated against. Put that with the average salary in Dominican Republic is about $50 a week. They're better off than their neighbor Haiti, but they are still in trouble. Anyway,
we got to take a break.
We are talking about the situation in Haiti on the border, not in Haiti, the situation on the border with Haitians trying to get into the United States and how President Biden is responding to this horrible crisis at the border. The conversation continues on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, it's a Friday, which means we've got GBH's own Callie Crossley stopping by. She'll break down her latest commentary on the Boston mayoral race. She says it boils down to a choice between NFH Wu, that's not from here, versus the OFD Asabi George, that's originally from Dorchester. We'll also discuss David Simon from The Wire's decision to steer his next series about Texas away from Texas and why.
Facebook has had to reckon with a lot of bad press over the past, well, 15 years or so. But now, workers at the social media behemoth have cooked up a new solution, using their newsfeed to promote positive PR for themselves. What does it mean for Facebook users to have their news diet set by Mark Zuckerberg? And what does it mean for the future of journalism? All that and more ahead, Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. He is Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. Welcome to hour number two of Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Hello again, Jim.
Hello again, Marjorie. And joining us, as she does every Friday, in studio. And I don't think we've had an in-studio guest maybe in months, or maybe Jared a month or two ago. In any case, joining us in studio, as she does every Friday. Well, not in studio, but she joins us every Friday, is the host of Under the Radar, Say It, Jim, with Kelly Crossley. That would be, of course, Kelly Crossley. Hello there.
Face-to-face,
Kelly Crossley.
Hello, wow. Hello, Kelly Crossley. Well, let's start with what we just talked with our listeners about, and we talked earlier with Ali Narani about, who is an immigration expert. What should we be doing? What's your reaction to what's going on the border with the Haitians?
Well, the border is the symptoms of, as we all know, and that's true probably of all the other border situations. So to me, the first thing and the biggest thing is get to the country and, you know, give the people the resources and do the kind of work that we, you know, that kind of peacekeeping work we've been doing in other war-torn countries, considered us a war-torn country, and get down there and let's rebuild. And we have the capacity to do that. I think, you know, it's not a very big country. Listen, if we could, for years, help prop up the Afghans as they try to fight against the Taliban, good God, those people are, yes, well, we don't need to say. And we can't go to Haiti and try to at least wrangle up some of these gangs that, I mean, yeah. Really? I mean, I just think that the lack of resources so often are at the source of many of these issues. You know, what the experts call the social determinants of health and well-being. It's just some of that could be addressed in a very significant way, not piecemeal. Get to the, you know, we've discussed this before, make sure it gets to the people on the ground who've been doing the work, and there still are people there who've been doing the work. You know, what an impact we could have. Then, at the very least, You stop having that overflow under a bridge. Now, once they arrive there, then I think you gotta, you know, give the people the chance to appeal for asylum. That's what the law says. That does not mean that all of them get in. They do not. We have to keep saying that. But at least they should have the opportunity. And we're talking about a population of folks who have been in a long history of some discriminatory practice when it comes to migration and immigration, because I was speaking with both of you in the break about the one-foot policy having to do with the Haitians and the Cubans, which simply meant that if the Cubans got in a boat and got to the shore of America and got one foot on land, all is well, but not the Haitians. They were turned around. So this is not new. Different situation to some degree, but same response. And we have to look at that and say, could we do better in a humanitarian effort? I think we can, particularly given our history of messing around in the country with this leadership. That's what I think.
Yeah, that's what the guy who spent 6 years was talking about, our history with that country, and we do have to do better. So can we go from Haiti, or at least the southern border, back to Boston? You did an interesting analysis of the final, which will be in early November, in the race for mayor between Asabi George and Wu. What was your take on the race, Kelly Crossley?
That it's a race between the OFD, originally from Dorchester, that would be Anissa Asabi George, and the NFH, the not from here, Michelle Wu, because she's a Chicago transplant, even though she's been here most of her adult life. And that, what were the implications of those identifiers in this town that is very neighborhood-based, very, to some degree, people would say tribal-based, and also it speaks to racial implications. So,
wasn't there a candidate, you know, when I read your piece, I meant to ask you, and I don't think it was Asabi George, maybe it was, there was a candidate, which means it would have been one of the three who didn't make it, if I'm right, who did regularly say, without mentioning Wu specifically, I was born here. I've spent my whole life here. It's almost like they're, you know, you're an other. If you were, I mean, I've lived in Cambridge, by the way, for decades. Decades and decades, not good enough. If I lived to 130, it's not good enough.
That's right.
Because I'm not from there, of thing, even though I consider myself a Cambridge person. And by the way, I think that will be part, I don't know this, we have Asabi George on the show next Thursday. I think that will be part of her campaign if it's not.
Oh my God, it is.
You think it is?
In the ads? I'm the teacher, the mother, and we'll be the mayor to get things done.
Well, the accent sort of does it. You don't have to say anything.
Those are Boston roots. There is no way around it. You hear her and you get it. And why shouldn't she be proud of her roots? I'm not saying she shouldn't be. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying that in this town, the first time I ever heard the expression OFD, I think I was sitting around in the radio studio about to interview some politician from there. And I said, OFD, what are you talking about? I was like, oh, my God, this could only happen in Boston.
Yeah. I'd be really interested to know how many people do we have in Boston now? 700 plus thousand? And I think we have 430 or 40,000 registered voters. I'd be really curious to know, as a follow-up to your piece, what percentage of the voters were born here? Because this is a big...
Wouldn't that be interesting?
I mean, obviously, huge college population. A lot of those kids stay here. So maybe before we see you next week, we'll take a look and see what the numbers are.
And there are plenty of the rest of us who've come from other places, you know, who've been here. I mean, this is to a large degree, a transient transplant city. So it's odd that even at this point in time, that the power of those roots would be so intense. And again, she should be proud of her roots, and Michelle Wu should be proud of what she brings. And the other thing I mentioned in my commentary is that if you look at leadership, a lot of the leadership, dare I say it, are transplants. you don't have to like it, but they brought their talent and skills from other places. They thought they'd been here long enough to be considered Bostonians, but not yet. You haven't been here for centuries and decades.
Well, you know, there was a governor not too far back who also came from Chicago who did a couple of terms here, by the way. Obviously, Deval Patrick.
Yes.
So,
I bet if you ask him, I bet nobody ever let him think he was from here.
That's right.
Oh, I'm sure that's the case. Well, he didn't shy away from it either. The story about him growing up and his grandmother and he wrote about and talked about was actually quite beautiful. We're talking to Callie Crossley, of course.
So, Callie Crossley, I've many times heard the expression that being black is a full-time job.
Oh, yeah.
This story about race in the workplace really floored me, though. It didn't surprise me so much when it said that only a tiny percentage of black employees, 3% according to this something called the Slack think tank Future Forum, want to go back to work full time. But when I saw But when I saw that it said they thought these workers that were talked to, black workers that were talked to, said that their ability to manage stress soared by 64% when they were working at home, as opposed to being in the workplace. So that says something. Well, what do you think that says about being black at work?
Well, there's a lot to be said about being black at work. I just like to point out that this study also underscores some other studies by black parents and other parents of color who said they feel better if their kids were in a remote situation to not have to face some of the daily microaggressions and just outright, you know, blatant kind of racist behavior, which contributes to your everyday life. So at home, many of them were saying this, you know, obviously comes with its own other set of problems or issues anyway, to consider. But when they're home, they're not, you know, their kids were not in the space to have to deal with that. And likewise, black employees, it's a lot every day doing it. Yet, if you're part of understanding that you're maybe the only one or one of the few, is that you're always being judged in your performance and it's got to be where it needs to be, which is, you know, two or three times better than everybody else. So now let's translate that to the remote workspace where we're just getting our arms around how do we measure people are doing the work and being productive, even though all the studies show we're very productive at home in a remote setting. So there's all of these things to consider. In fact, I know you're going to ask me later what I'm doing on my show coming up this Sunday. We're talking about the future of work. And this was brought up about from the work consultants about what they have seen in studies with regard to equity around the issues of who's in the office, who's not in the office, and what this means for persons of color, employees of color.
Too bad. I wasn't going to ask you this week what you're doing on your show. So it's lucky you brought it up. You know, by the way, Marjorie, I don't think there was enough emphasis when you said the 3%. Of all the reports I've seen during this don't go to work thing for a year and a half, and a lot of them knock your socks off. This is the number is 3% is within a margin of error. Means it could be 0%.
Yeah.
Essentially, virtually no black workers said, if I'm working at home, I want to go back.
Compared to 21% of white workers.
Right, exactly.
Mm-hmm. So it's a big number.
It is.
I mean, tiny number.
And if a lesson is not drawn from this, big time, bigly, as someone used to say,
yes.
they're missing it. Weren't you even shocked by the number, 3%?
Yeah, well, yeah, it is shocking. But I guess I'm not, you know, you can be shocked but not surprised. So that's sort of where I am.
Yeah, well, what this contributes to? The thing you and I discuss in the air almost every other day.
What's that?
Nobody's ever going back to work. I mean, you know, we can talk about, well, Labor Day was postponed till January, and then January, we'll see what happens. Nobody wants to go back to, I mean, it is stunning. We talk about the collaboration and the ability. I love, and I'm not just saying this because you're here, one of the few people I actually see from time to time in the newsroom is you, Kelly.
Yes, but I'm hybrid.
I know, well, so are we.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
So, I mean, this week I came in every day. That's really rare. Yeah. We haven't come in every day for a long time. And I really like the collegiality and the collaboration, this sort of osmosis thing when you're in the same space. But the vast majority of people in every workplace I know, with this as a, you know, sort of a grand underline, are don't want to go back to work except maybe occasionally. So in any case.
And you'll hear why on Under the Radar this Sunday.
Well, again, I wasn't going to bring it up. But
it's interesting, though, too, that there was that kid that was interviewed by The Globe that worked at Citizens Bank. He was 24. Mm-hmm. It was his first job. And he doesn't know anybody.
Yes.
So he's going
and
to the office.
And doesn't know anything.
Right.
Right. Yeah. So he talked about how he wanted to go to the office so he could learn things from his mentors.
Exactly.
But he also wanted to go to the office because he just got out of college. He's got no social life, nobody. So I can
He hasn't met his coworkers
right.
either.
Yeah. So I can see if you are a kid
yes.
and you have no network of friends and you came here from someplace else, like yeah. a lot of us end up doing, and you're, what are you going to do? You're in your apartment all day long.
I think young workers.
Then at the end of the day, you've got no one to go meet with because you don't know anybody.
I agree, Marjorie, and at the risk of sounding like somebody hawking a book, let me hawk my show and say, in the show, we do discuss the survey done by the McKinsey Group
yes.
about the results of their survey with young people and who don't know anything and don't know that and what happens there. So.
And also the people that work at places like some people I know, one of my kids worked at a place where they have the meditation room at work. They have free lunches.
Yeah.
They have free breakfasts.
Yeah.
They have the workout room. They have all this stuff at the office.
So that you never go home.
But also so you don't have to worry about anything like making your sandwiches and stuff like that. So I think those offices are more like second homes are missed by some.
You know, if Callie mentions her show one more time, the tease of her show will be longer than her show. So let's see. You know, this next story I love. David Simon is the
yes.
guy behind my second favorite show ever, The Wire, a lot of people's favorite show ever. And if you haven't seen it, it's hard to get into for some people, including mm-hmm. me. Mm-hmm. It is beyond brilliant. 5 brilliant seasons. He had a show that he was doing about Texas that he has decided to pull out of Texas. Why?
Because of the Texas newly passed anti-abortion law. And his exact words were, "My response is not rooted in any debate about political efficacy or the utility of any boycott. My singular responsibility is to securing and maintaining the civil liberties of all those we employ during the course of a production." So he said, this offends the civil liberties of everyone, but particularly his female employees, and he's not going to put money into Texas. This is a big deal. Apparently, there are some other places. I think the other really, really big one is Salesforce CEO
mm-hmm.
Has offered his employees in Texas the option of relocating with support from the company.
Yeah.
That's huge. If people don't know about Salesforce, I can't describe what they do, but I do know this. It's the only company that performed an audit to make sure that all of the female employees and male employees were paid the same, equitably.
Really?
Yes, under the direction of this guy.
Wow.
They are way ahead in terms of, you know, workers and appreciation and a good working space. So this would be normal for him to say, this is a lot of pressure for employees in Texas, and we're going to make it easier for you. But that's big.
You know, David Simon went out of his way. You read verbatim what he said. He went out of his way to say, this is not a boycott,
mm-hmm.
even though I would argue a boycott by any other name is still a boycott.
Mm-hmm.
Some other high-profile performers, artists, et cetera, were saying they are boycotting. And in this story, and I was glad it came up, there were some unions that were saying, you're screwing us. Mm-hmm. We're on your side.
Mm-hmm.
But we're losing jobs because that's the conundrum in any boycott. You're obviously hurting workers in the state you're boycotting. You're hurting individuals who benefit from that company. But the concept behind a boycott, the hope at least, obviously, is if you take extraordinary measures, hopefully it's going to rectify in unacceptable situation. So in the long term, like those states where, you know, like the NBA pulled its all-star game, and all of a sudden the leaders had an epiphany kind of thing. And I think those who are choosing to boycott Texas because of this, as we've called this ruthless anti-abortion law, the long-range goal is to get these people, these leaders, in quotes, to realize that if you want business to function here, you got to treat people humanely.
Well, in the end, I see this as a voting story. And so the unions and others who are unhappy put the pressure on the people sitting there making up these. And of course, you know, they've just passed this restrictive voting law as well that, you know, oftentimes people look at some of those laws and say, that doesn't impact me. Okay. But actually it does, because then on the not so periphery are lots of people making business decisions that do this. You know, I told you all before, I grew up in a house where we boycotted everything because my mother was not playing, and we did not put one dime toward anything. I don't care if we were the only people in the state. My father would have to ask before going out to shop, okay, what can I buy?
That's pretty good. No grapes in that household.
No.
Well,
you know, but can I just say one more thing about that? The good news, you know, almost every week you ask John King or Chuck Dodd, Marjorie, why are the people in Florida supporting DeSantis? Why are the people in Texas supporting Abbott? The newest polls out of Texas show that Beto O'Rourke is within, if he hasn't announced, within 5 points of Abbott in a poll, and that Matthew McConaughey, who also may run, is 9 points ahead of. Now, obviously, he's a celebrity, but still.
Isn't he very, very conservative?
No, I don't think so. Maybe I'm wrong. I'll check.
Well, he's not Greg Abbott. Let's go there.
The point being, well, Abbott may be in trouble, is the point, is that people aren't responding to the voting rights, the gun carry laws, in the effusive way that obviously he. And did you see they lined up all those cars
on the border?
Oh,
the state trooper cars on the border is like, keep these people out of here. And it's also interesting because the leadership in Texas is very Republican, but the people. We constantly hear stories about the
getting
state.
Getting more purple.
Want
to talk about a transplant situation. You know, there's lots of transplants to Texas that so they cannot reliably be read at all anymore because of that.
Yeah.
So we'll, you know, it's interesting.
You know, this is a little off topic, but Jim and I debate this a lot. The reaction of American women if we are going backwards on abortion.
Gosh.
What do you think would happen? I mean, do you think, because it is very possible that the Supreme Court will overturn Roe?
Well, I've been thinking about writing about this actually for one of my commentaries. And the first thought that has been in my mind now for weeks, I just have to expand upon it, is that we're returning to the Underground Railroad. That's it. It will not stop. And there will be those who will, you know, put themselves out there to offer protection in what would be at that point an illegal way to make certain that people get to safe materials and be supported. And remember, in Texas, it's really scary because if anybody thinks you're doing something, they can report you. It reminds me exactly of those time periods where people were enslaved in this country and folks took risks. I remind people all the time, there's many Underground Railroad stops in this area, but the museum, the African American Museum in Boston, has a special space where they do tours for kids.
Yeah.
And it's important to see what people were willing to sacrifice, both the people that protected those people at great risk to themselves. We're talking, you know, death and all kinds of violence pre-death, and the people who were taking those risks. I mean, let's face it, Harriet Tubman could not have made it, good as she is, without the Underground Railroad.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's what we're, you know, I'm sorry to say, that's what's going to happen. Now, it's a different time, so what levels of sophistication can be made to what is essentially the same process, I don't know, but that's exactly what's going to happen.
And you think there will be a political blowback? I would certainly think
so. Oh, of course. Well, I'm assuming that. But I thought you were asking what
I was.
You know, what was happening to the women.
Yeah, I was.
Yeah.
Okay.
By the way, I'm just very quickly, before we ask Callie about what she's doing on her show, I'm looking, as you two were talking, McConaughey, at least a couple of articles I was able to skim quickly, people say they really don't know his politics, that they're not clear if he's running as a Republican, running as a Democrat. The only thing they say this is one piece in a local, I think it's a Houston television station, he was very outspoken about gun violence and pro-gun control.
Oh.
But beyond that, I guess Callie has the most accurate analysis. He's not Greg Abbott.
Right.
Meaning, if Greg Abbott was so popular, regardless of where McConaughey is coming from, it appears to be more of an anti-Abbott vote than a pro-anybody
else probably true.
Kind of thing. And the what's heartening about that is the people of Texas, regardless of where they end up going, obviously are not in love with some of these policies that at least you and I think they shouldn't be in love in. So
Callie, you did give us a hint about what you're doing on your show.
But it was so long ago, we forget.
Right. But this is off a survey, a study?
No, we've been working on this for some time, just trying to pull together all of, in an aggregate way, what are the sentiments of both employees and employers, looking at the power of employees in this moment. Is it just for this moment? Is it long lasting? What do some of these surveys say? I mean, there's many that people will just quit. So this is, as you know, the big quit and the big resignation. That's what they're calling it. And it is happening. All of my consultants who work with very big firms are there to say, if employers insist you must come back, as a Facebook and Google and some are saying, because they're even building new offices, you will lose talent. So it's your choice. Do you want to lose talent? But the competitive world is going to be in some offerings that are rooted in remote work. Now, the challenges are, as one of my consultants said, not how do we go back, how do we go forward in this new way? So you got leadership that may be fixed in one way, not realizing that we have to just review our thoughts about how we work. You know, it's not 9 to 5 anymore.
No.
It's a whole other way.
I love it, though.
Yes.
Because it does seem to me that for decades, employers had such the upper hand. And we're seeing the employee. What are you laughing at?
How'd you describe you and me? In the hall? We were talking about this in the hall yesterday. How'd you describe you and me when we bumped into each other at the start of the day? We were talking about this topic, and Marjorie says, you know what you and I are? Suckers. That's what we've been. Coming into work for decades, working ridiculous hours.
Well, I do.
Suckers.
Yeah, like I worked on Saturdays for 30 years.
Yeah.
Well, what a fool I was.
With the Herald we're talking about. Which
and it never occurred to me that was, you know, that
advance.
Maybe after 30 years,
right,
I shouldn't have to work on Saturdays anymore.
Well, here's the thing that a lot of parents will be happy to repeat to their children who have been slacking off doing the work to get them where it's the talented, it's the credentialed who will have the most power in this moment. Because that's what the war is about, that kind of talent.
Yeah.
There are so many interesting things going on as we are talking about this evolving space. And we have a teacher who said, gotta go. You're making me do something. Nope, gotta go. So
you know what else is happening.
I
think also that the cost of childcare is so astronomical. And I was hopeful that maybe we might do something about this in the $3.5 trillion infrastructure social safety net bill. But I'm getting very discouraged about it. That's the prospects. But that if you only have to pay for 3 days a week of childcare, man, instead of 5 days a week of childcare, you were talking about a college tuition saving kind of thing.
Well, here's my thing, which I intend to comment on shortly. How about these people with these big buildings that they're not going to have all the people in anymore? You want to know how to get people back in a nanosecond? Put some child care in there. Hire some people. I'm telling the truth. Yeah. You will get some loyal employees, whether they want to be or not. I'm telling you.
Yeah.
That's the competitive field that everybody's overlooking. Child care. That's it.
Well, let me just say this. The good news for people who are hoping they'd have free time to do things on Sunday night is there's no reason to listen to Callie Crossley Under the Radar.
No,
she's told you the whole damn thing right here.
She'll have her guests. Callie, thank you very much as always. Great to see you. Actually, great to see you in person.
That is actually.
But we've seen you in person before.
Yes.
You're one of the only people here who's here in person.
I am. I'm walking the halls.
Anyway, Callie Crossley, who is here in person, is the host of Under the Radar with Callie Crossley, which you can catch Sunday nights right here, 89.7 GBH at 6 o'clock. You can subscribe to her Under the Radar podcast on iTunes. Follow her on Twitter at Callie Crossley. Somebody asked me how to spell your name. I'll spell it CalleCrossley. Thanks again to Callie. Coming up, we'll talk tech with Andy Inako. He's going to talk about how work from work policies are creating worker outrage at Apple. We're going to keep on the work subject. That's next on 89.7 Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Marjorie Egan and Mijun Browdy joining us to go over the latest headlines at the intersection of tech, policy, and commerce is Andy Inako. Andy, of course, is a tech writer and blogger. You can find his work at Inako.com. You can follow him at IHNATKO. Andy, great to talk to you.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Hey, Andy Inako. So let's start with a story that tops your list. They're starting to complain about the workplace at the formerly so secretive Apple. What's going on
at the fruit company? Yeah, I mean, over the past year or two, we've definitely been talking about companies like Google who have had really, like, in full view Donnybrooks over how badly certain employees have been treated. And as always, you wonder, gee, we're hearing some of these stories from Facebook. Amazon has pretty much decided that's going to be its brand, employee abuse. But you don't hear anything about this happening inside of Apple. So either you think that this is one of the only $2 or $3 trillion companies with 150,000 employees that treats employees extremely well consistently, or they are just really, really good at either directly or indirectly intimidating people to just, hey, you work at Apple, keep your yap shut, be grateful, and don't complain. And so over the past several months, a lot of this sort of tension about I can't say anything, I'm going to get in trouble, I'm definitely going to get fired. A lot of this tension has sort of ratcheted down. A lot of employees have felt empowered to go public and talk openly amongst each other about some of their concerns. And that's the sort of, I wouldn't say it's a crisis yet, but this is what Apple's dealing with. I mean, the fact that we're even talking about this as a news story, and it is a news story, means really to show that there is a problem inside of Apple. Because again, if your unofficial corporate policy for employees is keep your yap shut, be content, that's not a great workplace. That merits some investigation and some discussion.
Well, it's not just keep your mouth shut. And if you don't keep your mouth shut, we will find a vehicle to shut your mouth. Meaning, you mentioned that, you know, for example, there was a Slack channel that employees are upset about had put together, and Apple shut it down. I mean, they're essentially censuring the speech of their own people, no?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And this is why it's a little bit off-putting. Because it's like there's a standard playbook that once an employee starts complaining beyond the desire of the company to listen to them complain, they are put into a very efficient machine that processes them step by step by step. One of these classic things is to say that, oh, well, you're using an employee bulletin board and employee email to talk about labor issues. In this case, some employees were trying to start up a Slack channel on the Apple internal Slack server to talk about pay equity issues, and they just shut it down with the excuse that, oh, no, no, it has nothing to do with the fact that you're union organizing. It's that this is not related to Apple, your work at Apple. And then The Verge, like, cleared its throat and said, yeah, you've got, like, you've approved Slack channels for, like, Frisbee golf, for Dobermans, for things like that. None of those things have anything to do with work at Apple either. I suspect that you're actually more on the let's get some Pinkerton men in and intimidate people into not talking. But the big thing is, and again, we're talking about the playbook here. All summer, we've been sort of following the story of a senior engineer, project manager named Ashley Jovic, who has been going public with some of the complaints that she's been having at Apple. And I should absolutely make it clear that none of these complaints she's been making have been proven or verified. She has lodged official complaints with the National Labor Relations Board. Too many acronyms in my line of work. I stopped at the third letter to make sure I've got them right. But yeah, so she's got she's one of two or three people who have actions filed against. The government has not yet decided whether they're going to pursue it yet. So let's make that very clear. But the reason why I tend to give the story credibility is that she is, again, not being hesitant about sharing her information about, here is the emails that I've been getting. Here is my timeline. Here is exactly what was said to me, and here is screenshots from my devices about what was said to me that I felt was intimidating. And of course, what happened, the playbook as it is, again, Google did this to Dr. Tim DeGebru, the head of ethical AI, when they wanted to get her out too. So the playbook is, number one, the company takes action that will lead to increased harassment and increased retaliation, therefore putting more pressure on the person. Then you intimidate this person into taking a leave of absence that you can then say was, oh, no, she requested a leave of absence, and then we granted it to her. Then during in this case, it was a paid leave of absence, so it's not as though she was not able to house or feed herself. But, of course, during this leave of absence, all of a sudden, all of her responsibilities were reassigned to other people. And by the time she came back, she had no responsibilities left at the company. And then you get to the end of the processing line, in which, just like with Dr. Gebru, Apple came up with a real baloney accusation, saying that she got an email that, again, she was kind enough to repost to her blog, saying that we're investigating some serious allegations that you improperly disclosed Apple confidential information, the confidential product-related information in violation of Apple policies and your obligations under the intellectual property agreement that you signed, and we're going to require you to participate in this investigation. I need to hear back from you within the hour. And again, according to the email that she posted, she replied, oh, no, absolutely, be happy to help you, but again, given that I actually have like a complaint with NLRB against you, let's just do this via email so that there's a paper trail. And then within an hour, she got an email from employee relations saying, oh, we're so sorry, but, you know, because these allegations were so serious and you coldly and, I don't know, we're incredibly refused to participate in the investigation, we are left with no alternative but to fire you for cause. So again,
by the way, this is not as a former union president, this is not unusual behavior on the part of an employer. The difference is, yeah, Apple holds itself up as a beacon of freedom, right, and free speech. And you know, talk about the perfect bookends. On one hand, Apple isn't happy about what its workers saying about it, so it essentially shuts them down. And Facebook isn't happy about what the world is saying about it, so now they're going to use their own newsfeed to post positive stories that they themselves have created about themselves. I mean, is that, did I get that right?
Yeah. You got that right, and you that's not even a third of it. There's a New York Times is one of only the latest like international paper of record to again have the benefit of internal employees that have had enough and are now leaking information to respected reporters, so that information on what happens inside the company gets out. So the New York Times had a really big story this week that talked about this, that they had this thing that they were calling Project Amplify. Now, normally the Facebook news feed, there would be news about Facebook within it, but normally sort of neutral stuff about, oh, hey, we're introducing this new feature, you should know about it. So according to a January meeting in which the strategy was introduced and approved by everybody, including Mark Zuckerberg personally, they decided that we're going to start crafting our own stories that elevate and amplify pro Facebook news stories and put this in the news feed so that everyone sees it. I had to be snarky, of course. As soon as I read the story, I had to tweet out that, okay, so now we have official acknowledgement from Facebook. They know how dangerous this tool can be in the hands of a tyrant to manipulate people into believing horse hockey. But like I said, this is just a third of it. This was part of a comprehensive plan about, well, we're getting so much bad press. Well, maybe it's because we're doing bad things and we should revisit that and maybe not do bad things. Maybe not. They decided that, no, we have to take control of our PR a little bit better. So it's a laundry list of things that they decided to do this year. Well, amongst them, they thought that Zuckerberg was now becoming the face of Facebook apologies. Like every time he has to make a public statement about, yes, of course, we made the situation in the United States much, much worse. And the government is absolutely right. We're going to fix this. When he's testifying in front of Congress, that's not a good look. So part of the strategy is that now he's going to be more in the Steve Jobs sort of role of, hey, I'm the visionary tech guy, and hey, here's me on a hydrofoil waving an American flag because, again, I'm a cool tech guy. I'm not that evil person. And now the apologies are being done by the chief operations officer, Sheryl Sandberg, instead. We've talked about this a couple of weeks ago, where they're still doing independent internal research to look into the effects of Facebook projects and Facebook products. And if these internal research are proving that, hey, this really is negative, we got a big problem, the policy is let's bury it, really underscore the message that Facebook is a force of good that brings people together. And when people complain, go really aggressively against them, even if it's the president of the United States, Joe Biden. So this is I don't think that Facebook has a problem that can be solved with one meeting and a year's worth of applied effort. This is going to be years worth of reversing a corporate culture that is a cancer upon itself and pretty much the entire Facebook community. But it was especially distressing when they feel as though we're going to put a lot of focused, amplified, and determined effort towards basically making people ignore anything negative that researchers could turn up about this, including anytime stopping giving independent researchers access to Facebook data that could show the outside world exactly how Facebook has its effects upon users and communities. So this is, again, very on-brand for Facebook, and it's very, very still disappointing.
Yeah, the Wall Street Journal's got a big series, too, on Facebook, trashing them pretty much from beginning to end. So their efforts at getting good press is not really seemingly working that well. But let's move on to what's going on to this software provider that, you know, help you with your privacy online, ExpressVPN. Tell us about it.
Oh, this one really broke my heart. I've actually recommended this before.
Yes, yeah.
A VPN is a standard of networking, so that if you're using a public Wi-Fi access point, for instance, you're at a coffee shop, you're at an airport terminal, you're in a hotel lounge, it basically wraps your connection to the internet in this big safe cocoon of encryption, so that other people who are also connected to the same base station can't snoop into your traffic. And it's an important thing to have. It's part of basic security and safety hygiene online. You should have a VPN, and it should be something you pay money for. And ExpressVPN was and is really one of the best ones. It's not free, but it's not terribly expensive. But more to the point, it's something that you can install on your phone, on your computers, everything. It will be easy to work. It will just work, and it will keep you safe. Great, and this is why I've been recommending it. But they've had a bad couple of weeks of press of their own doing, of course. Okay, and it really illustrates that as much as you can do the vetting on a company to say, if I'm going to trust somebody to keep my data and to keep my internet connection safe, I want to research them and make sure that they're good people and that security experts also verify that they're good people and I can trust them. That's good to do, but what can happen is, like what happened with ExpressVPN, a company called Cape Technologies bought them for close to $1 billion a couple of weeks ago. And this company, has been buying up as many well-known and respected VPN services like ExpressVPN as they can. So that's problematic in and of itself, because that means that if this one company decides to pursue a policy that will weaken VPN so they can sell data collection services to law enforcement or to countries, they can simply apply one policy that will affect all these brands that nobody knows is all being controlled by the same company. Worse, and there's going to be a worser after this. So if you got liquor, get a good belt in. The worst part of it is that they rebranded themselves from a company called CrossRider that had a notorious security fail web browser product that people would unknowingly install thinking that was going to give you a good little feature. Its whole purpose, though, was to steal all of your ad traffic so that the company could basically use those ad placements and make money off of their own ads instead. It's so bad that a lot of antivirus kits would identify this tool as malware and try to remove it. Okay, but now worse. Okay, maybe not worse as still, but still hair-raisingly notable. It turns out that the company's chief information officer used to cyber spy a lot for the United Arab Emirates and other people. Now, this I actually want to backtrack a little bit because this is not terribly unknown in the security community. You are basically you are a hired Clint Eastwood. Sometimes you spend 3 or 4 years. Cracking systems for hire for one group of people, but you still spend another 3 or 4 years being on the swapping your black hat for a white hat because you have to know exactly what these techniques are. You have to know what these vulnerabilities are in order to prevent people from doing it. But still, all of this means that I'm now thinking, oh God, how many times did I tell people I use ExpressVPN? I pay for it all the time. They used to be a sponsor of one of my podcasts 3 or 4 years ago, but they stopped like 2.5 years ago. But I've still used the service and I've always paid for it. And now I have to say, okay, well, if you're just a consumer and all you want to do is be able to use Starbucks Wi-Fi safely, it's still good for that. But you have to realize that VPN is like armor plating for a lot of people. Like if you are a political activist and you need a secure connection that can't be snooped on while you talk to other activists, coordinate activity, talk to the press, talk to human rights organizations, there are people in very, very fancy government presidential palaces that would very, very much like you to be off the playing board entirely. And you can't take – these people cannot take the risk that is now in presence with ExpressVPN. It is now it's the third rail. You cannot touch it anymore.
Andy, can I interrupt you for a second? Absolutely. Here? The thing that concerns me, if someone like me who's taken your advice and uses ExpressVPN is using it, how are we mere mortals supposed to know what you just described and rearm ourselves or reprotect ourselves when we're assuming that we were protected? Do you know what I mean?
Yep. It is tough. And I do want to reiterate that if you're using ExpressVPN, you are under no more risk today than you were a month ago. Like I said, for consumers, I don't think anything has really changed. But this is why I myself, you know, we try to remind ourselves that once a year, maybe twice a year when the clocks go forward and back, that's when you vacuum your smoke detector. That's when you change batteries in this. That's when you change the air filter in your car. Once a year, usually on January 1st, I really have a list of things I try to audit. And one of them is that if there's a service or a product or a piece of hardware that I trust to keep me safe online, I need to do that other Google search, Google like ExpressVPN vulnerabilities or ExpressVPN security breach to see what comes up after that, to make sure that they have held on to the opinion and public opinion that got me convinced that this would be a good thing for me to use as well. I mean, yes, this is not the sort of story that you will find you will find on Entertainment Tonight. You're not going to get it's not going to show up in your Facebook news feed. It's not going to show up in your YouTube feed. So it is something you have to proactively do. Everything that has to do with privacy, like the security camera that you might have installed, like the security doorbell you might have installed, once a year at the very least, do that Google search, the product name and vulnerability, security attack, privacy breach, to find out what you have not found out about since the last time you did that search, because this is a moving target, unfortunately. It's sad, but it is true.
We're talking to Andy Inako, our tech guy. This is a great story about Gen Z is now asked by their college professors to put things in the class folder, but they have a lot of difficulty putting things in the class folder. Why is that? In the course folder, I should say. Why is that, Andy?
It's great news and has nothing to do with making fun of teenagers and people in their early 20s. This is the sort of stuff I love to think about and talk about. The thing is, they grew up in a world where things did not – you could just basically toss everything inside your notebook's internal hard drive or inside a Dropbox and not care about putting it into folders, organizing it, or anything, because there is – anytime you need to get, there's that essay I started 4 days ago that's due tomorrow. I need to finish that up tonight. They're not going to – okay, double-click on class number 3, double-click on essays, then double-click on essays in progress. No, they're going to do – they're going to click on that very simple search box on that screen and type in essay about the power of corn, and then the computer will find it wherever it is and then present it to them. So this shows you how sophisticated computers have come, that what used to be absolutely fundamental knowledge for everybody to know is now kind of useless. And when you put people into a situation where here's, you can call somebody, here's our dial phone, they're not going to know how to use a dial phone because they've never had to use one of those before. It's only obvious to us because maybe we grew up using it. Even you can tell how keen I am on this topic, but I have to tell myself the shot clock is going down, the NBA shot clock. I have to wind myself down. But I was part of the I was the first person, I can tell you this for a fact, to submit an English essay on a floppy disk at my school, chiefly because the teacher thought I was lying when I said, "Oh no, I finished it on my home computer. I just have to go to the computer lab and print it." And it brought back all these memories of, you know, this is back when everything was usually like handwritten or typewritten, and it was like, okay, your first draft is going to be due on Tuesday, your second draft is due the following Tuesday, you're going to hand those in. I had to explain to them that I have no idea what you're talking about. I don't do drafts. I use a word processor where if I want to change a line, it's already changed. By the time I finish the first draft, it is like a ninth draft. And with that teacher specifically, I remember having conversations and saying, well, will it be okay if I simply do my first and final draft and then like make mistakes on it and submit those as intermediate drafts? And this is the sort of stuff we're talking about. You're dealing with people who never the button for picking up a phone call here on Skype in front of me, it is a telephone handset that will make no sense to anybody because they didn't grow up with these big chonky murder weapon grade telephone handsets. And that's why it just looks like, okay, here's to click on the Mickey Mouse ears button to hang up the call. And this is why I was just noticing this morning as I was preparing for the show, the hang up and pick up buttons on the Android phone app. It is really abstract. It doesn't absolutely remind you of a telephone. It just hints at what this used to be, because now people are just using the visual cue of the red button is going to hang up, the green button is going to pick up. And these are things we have to keep thinking about, because we think we have this paradigm. Well, obviously, documents are sheets of paper, and sheets of paper go into folders, and folders go into drawers. When actually, no, our relationship now for the past 20 years has been, no, information is in a database. Software takes the data out of the database according to what we're asking it to do, but then makes it look like a document, or makes it look like a picture, or makes it look like a slideshow. And so we have to appreciate that this stuff that helped everybody learn how to use computers for the first time in the 70s and 80s are now going to hold back a whole generation. And so it's about obliterating those kinds of artificial limitations that help us to get to the next level of things.
Andy Nocco, thank you very much, as always. Appreciate it.
We're glad you were able to vent, by the way. You sound like you feel a lot better as a result, and we're all better for it, Andy. Thank you.
I'm excited, and now I can enjoy my apple cider donut that I decided to hold off until after this.
The best donuts in the world.
I'm a little sugar minus right now because of how much fun I was having.
Take care, Andy. Good to talk to you. Andy, thanks a lot.
Andy Nocco joins us regularly. He's a tech writer and blogger. You can find his work at anocco.com, and follow him at Anocco, which is I-H-N-A-T-K-O. Thanks again to Andy. Coming up, how President Biden is trying to make amends for the damage done by the military's controversial Do Not Ask, Do Not Tell policy. Sue O'Connell, our media maven, joins for that and more. She's next on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio. He's Jim Browdy.
And she's Marjorie Egan. And this is 89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1 Boston, online at gbhnews.org. Boston's local NPR. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Marjorie Egan and Jim Browdy. So President Bush is responsible for launching the Forever Wars. Is President Bill Clinton responsible for launching the Forever Culture Wars? His Don't Ask, Don't Tell military policy forced gays and lesbians to serve in silence for years. This week marks the 10th anniversary of the ban's repeal, and the Biden administration has announced that LGBTQ vets who were discharged under Don't Ask, Don't Tell have a new chance for full benefits, but it's not easy. Join us online to talk about this, the fall of Fall River's mayor, the former mayor, not the current mayor, and more as Media Maven Sue O'Connell. Sue's the co-publisher of Bay Windows and the South End News. She's a contributor to Current on NBC, LX, and NECN. Hello, Sue O'Connell. Exactly. As I was saying, hello, Sue O'Connell. Okay.
Sue perhaps is not there.
Do we not have Sue, or is there a problem on our... Okay.
Oh, we can hear. Well, I can hear her in the background.
We'll get there in a second. And,
oh, that's weird. Okay, hold on.
There she is. That's weird. No,
hi. Got, yeah, nothing.
Hi.
I did nothing differently. I'm just sitting here talking to myself.
Easy
okay,
for you
hi.
To say. Welcome. Hello.
Hello, Sue O'Connell.
Hi. Good to see you.
Great to... Oh, are you on Zoom? Should I be looking for
yeah,
you?
No, I meant keep... that was just kind of a, yeah, we'll just keep moving forward
okay,
with
we'll just,
our parade
we'll just keep,
of
we'll
horrible
moving forward. Okay. So let's start with the Fall River mayor. You know, it started out very well for Jaziel Correa. He was the Fall River Youth of the Year when he was 17 years old.
I didn't know that
old.
Till today, actually.
I did not know that either. He's not much older than that. I think he's in his late 20s.
He's 29.
And he's facing 6 years in prison now for basically what he got nailed for. There was a lot of other stuff that went on. The judge threw it out, Douglas P. Woodlock. But he got the 6 years mostly for putting the squeeze on marijuana companies that were trying to open in Fall River. He claims no responsibility, that the truth is going to come out at some point. But I don't know that many people are convinced by that. So is there a lesson here? I guess...
Oh,
don't squeeze the marijuana companies. Don't buy expensive gifts for your girlfriend with ill-gotten gains. Don't tell your secretary she can't keep a raise. She has to give it to you.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Marjorie, this is such a, again, another terrible setback for Fall River, right?
Yeah.
You know, like it's always the city on the verge. It's always a place that many lawmakers and business people look to and say, this is the time for Fall River. So, you know, all of the comedy of errors that go along with former Mayor Correa's criminal activity. I mean, I feel terrible again for the citizens and folks of Fall River. And again, we have another example of someone who's engaging in criminal behavior, but for some reason doesn't think it's criminal enough to hide, right? You know,
yeah.
I mean, the things, just the laundry list that you just went through of things that he did and showing off this money, right? In jewelry and cars, and if you looked at the court records and read some of the testimony, there was like no effort whatsoever to even pretend that these were legal efforts or, you know, political pressure or political power. And as you said, you know, the final tipping point was asking these marijuana companies for bribes, which, by the way, marijuana is such a big business now, and they are so concerned because federally there are still challenges for them. They still can't, marijuana companies still can't get, you know, decent banking. They're not going to engage in any bribery behavior, right? Because they're going to go down in flames, no pun intended, if they get caught. And then there were other things that he did that were thrown out just because it didn't meet the technical definition of what wire fraud is. So, you know, I just don't understand how people, I'd love to say it was because he was young and inexperienced, but this kind of behavior is just inexcusable for a public servant. And I hope that, you know, this closes the book on this chapter for Fall River, and they can move forward, because, you know, it's just both comical and despicable.
You know, one of the things Woodcock said, even though he was pretty, is that his name, Woodcock, the judge?
Woodlock.
Woodlock.
Yeah,
oops,
Woodlock.
Sorry.
Woodlock.
Is he was very tough on the corruption thing, said far worse than anything Diane Wilkerson or Sal DeMacy or whatever did.
Or James Michael Curley.
But he talked about how he did. And he talked about how, but, you know, you'll have a chance to hopefully get your life together. He'll only be 35 at oldest when he gets out. I have to say, well, I hope so, too, I guess, with almost any human being. The fact that he can't, when the crimes are so clearly proven, as Sue said, because he was brazen about everything,
and was
won't acknowledge anything and shows no remorse,
right,
doesn't suggest to me at 35 he's going to be any better citizen of the community than he was at 24, 25, 26, up through his charging and conviction. It's pretty pathetic case. And by the way, the one thing you didn't say is, my understanding, some of the people he really screwed in some of these schemes is were people who really loved him, people he was really close with, you know? I mean, this is
well,
a
the only way you can be
punk.
That I don't want to portray him as successful, but the only way you can be that successful a con is to have a great amount of charisma and really encourage and inspire people to believe in you. So, you know, that trust that he inspired, of course. And sadly, I agree with you 100%, Jim. You know, these are the type of people that you see come out of jail and then start something else, right? This is unfortunately a behavior that I'm not sure jail fixes. But we should just keep an eye on him when he gets out of jail and make sure if he starts some kind of meditation camp that we don't sign up for.
Well, you know, one of the things that the judge pointed out, and I thought it was significant, is that he knew he was beat, that the feds had their eye on him for some fraudulent activity involving this company he started when he was in college. So even while he knew he was in the sights of law enforcement, he continued to do these other crimes. So that
right.
takes a certain amount of chutzpah at the very least. And, you know, I remember meeting him. I told you this at an event I was out for. I was stunned because he was so young. He was elected when he was, you know,
23, was it?
Early 20s.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I did not get a feeling of a feel good feeling. Let's put it that way. Shaking his hand. He didn't. I was kind of surprised. There was a district attorney from former DA Sam Sutter from New Bedford that he beat. That used to be the mayor. Well, I guess he couldn't be from New Bedford. He's the mayor of Fall River. But anyway, Sam Sutter that he beat, and I guess they people were upset because he was going to chart. They were going to get charged for their garbage bags or something like that, and they wound up putting this kid in. But I'm surprised so many people fell for him because he did not seem to me to be very. I mean, I know a lot of people in Fall River, obviously, I come from there, who were stunned as well.
Yeah, but in all fairness, there are a lot of shady people in Fall River. So, I mean, it isn't like it's that big a deal. So, as a
person from Revere, that's why I'm so appalled at how
brazen
he was.
You
so
would
I don't
know what you're talking
how,
about.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, you know, I saw the mayor of Revere on Jim's TV show.
Are we
show.
Still doing this?
I saw the mayor on your TV
Brian
show.
Brian Errico,
you're always
last
happy
night.
When I mentioned your TV show.
Yeah, thank you. He was on last
I thought he did not look like – he looked like he was a very – scholarly kind of person. I thought, wow.
He was great. I thought he was great.
Of Revere.
He's in a contretemps with Kim Janey about moving people, transitional housing for homeless people from Mass and Cass to this Quality Inn in Revere in 30 rooms. And he says there wasn't adequate consultation. They say there was. He's a pretty impressive guy. I agree.
You Revere girl. Is this unusual to elect a scholar kind of type?
Listen. Mayor Colella was a two-term mayor elected and then beat by Bill Reinstein, you know, who also ended up, I think, in jail, but also helped build the high school that I attended. You know, I think the lawmakers and leaders in Revere.
Everybody makes mistakes.
This is a total
jail
waste
term.
Of time.
A couple of years.
Can
in the
we
can.
Go to 10-year anniversary of the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell? Could you explain briefly the genesis of this thing for younger viewers or people who don't have a sense of history, and what the fallout, long-term fallout, which I am embarrassed to say I wasn't aware of until I prepared for you today, has been?
Yeah, so take yourselves back to 1992, 1993, when another young upstart, Bill Clinton, moved to the White House, someone else who was fine about committing acts, even though he was under investigation for an act at the time, Paula Jones. So Bill Clinton went into the White House with a really good heart about gays and lesbians and could not understand why gays and lesbians were not treated as fairly as they should. He was a revolutionary mind when it came to gay and lesbian rights. And then he immediately tried to force the military to lift the ban on gays and lesbians serving in the military. And of course, since he had no experience in the military and didn't really know what he was doing and didn't consult with anyone, what he ended up doing was angering the military, angering the gay rights groups, and came up with this split the baby idea, which was don't ask, don't tell. And this was, I think, in 1993. And the idea was that you could serve in the military if you were gay, but you couldn't be openly gay. You wouldn't be asked if you were gay, and you shouldn't tell if you're gay. Now, of course, if you imagine what that must be like if you're serving overseas and all of your colleagues are talking about the people who they love and the people back home, but you're not allowed to participate, You can imagine what a nightmare this was. And what happened was that people ended up still being kicked out of the military, and they were kicked out primarily affecting African Americans and people of color and women, especially straight women, and women who would file a claim against a leader, a harassment claim. They'd be accused of being a lesbian. They'd drum up some sort of evidence about them, and they would be discharged. And this went on until 10 years ago, when finally Don't Ask, Don't Tell was retired, and folks who were gay could serve openly in the military. However, everybody before that who had been discharged, on different levels of it, certainly, but were unable to access the support that the military offers after you leave. That's VA benefits, education benefits. Some of them, you know, the stories of their discharge for being caught being gay led to alcoholism, led to suicides. I mean, it's just a terrible, terrible road of stories of people who volunteered to serve our military and then, you know, ended up being cast aside. And so what Joe Biden did was change a policy that allowed many of these veterans to access the services they didn't have. And again, the good news is that he's able to do that. And the bad news is that presidents before him could have done it and didn't, but it doesn't codify it into law. So it's also a tenuous Band-Aid fix to this ongoing issue, which, of course, you know, the road to hell, as they say, paved with good intentions, with Bill Clinton trying to integrate the military for gays and lesbians. And we've ended up with this long tail of sorrow for people, again, who volunteered to serve the military. And I notice we're on the heels of Afghanistan here. You know, many experts have pointed out that part of the problem that we had, United States in Afghanistan, is that we didn't speak the language. And Jim and Marjorie, you'll remember that there were expulsions of gays serving in the military who were experts in language and experts in the languages spoken in the Middle East and high level people serving. And they were expelled from the military because they were gay. And, you know, so that's why you should care about this, right? Because there are people, again, volunteering to serve, and they weren't getting the benefits they deserved.
A couple of statistics from this story in the Washington Post is, I'll read, studies have found that 15% of LGBTQ vets attempt suicide, compared with less than 1% for the entire veteran population, even though it's high anyway.
Yep.
And they go on to say that as of 2016, obviously pre-Biden, the Associated Press did an analysis showing that only 8% of the 13,000 people expelled under the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy had applied to upgrade their discharges so that they'd be eligible for the benefits they were otherwise denied, and which is what makes Biden's attempt to make it easier to do whatever you got to do to qualify for benefits that other veterans who served and are getting, you get, is so incredibly important. And it's really it's really a horrible story, because you think, I mindlessly say, well, they repealed the policy. That's great, which it was. And, you know, the problem goes away. And obviously, it's sort of like long COVID. It's long, horrible consequences for being yourself. So, you know, good for Biden for trying to fix this.
Right. And hopefully it'll be turned into law, and then we won't have to worry about it in the future.
So we're talking to Sue O'Connell. Sue, I cannot tell a lie. I thought Elvira was gay. I thought I love the Elvira and the character. What's her name, by the way? I can't remember. What's
Cassandra
her name?
Peterson.
Cassandra Peterson. Yes. I thought she was a lesbian all along, but apparently the reason she hid her sexual orientation was because men were, she thought, wildly attracted to her. And she thought if she made it clear that she was, in fact, bisexual and had a long-term relationship with another woman, that it was going to destroy her appeal. And then all of a sudden she had an epiphany. Is that pretty much the story?
That is exactly it. I don't have to say anything.
So why'd she eventually decide to in a book, come out? Okay.
Yeah. I mean, so Elvira, for those who might not remember, this is kind of story time corner with Sue. Halloween used to be a gay holiday. It used to be only for the LGBTQ people and kids, right? It was also the only time that straight men got to wear dresses and get away with it, right? But now it's a family, multi-billion dollar industry. But, you know, the gays, we still think of Halloween as the high holidays, right? Yeah. And Elvira was, of course, the mistress of the dark, but also a gay icon, and had been a gay icon. And that's why, Jim, I think you thought she was either already gay.
Yep.
She was on RuPaul's Drag. I mean, she's just been everywhere. She's very obviously LGBTQ friendly at a time when it wasn't easy to be. So we love her. She loved us. And apparently she fell in love with somebody at the gym. And became friends. And after her marriage to a man broke up, they became romantically involved, and now they've been together. But again, you know, even with all of that cushioning, no pun intended, if you will, of her being part of the gay community as an icon, having a really strong fan base of people who love her, because her appeal, and I was able to meet her a couple of times in the 1980s I worked at KISS. Yeah, and she's a great person. She's really warm, and then she turns on, you know, the Mistress of the Dark. And if you haven't ever seen it, it's very sexy, very, you know, cis-centered, really playing up to men. And I think that she, as she says in her book, she says that she really worried that if she came out, it would hurt her fan base or make her fan base unhappy, which is, you know, just again, even at this time where we are in, you know, 2021, people still very, very concerned about what the public is going to think about them when it comes to their public image. So I'm just glad she's out. It's what the gays needed for Halloween 2021, is Elvira to officially join the Halloween queerdom.
Well, you know what else I found interesting was the whole story, the fluidity in her sexuality. She talked about that, as you said, she had been with a man, and then she met this woman at the gym, and they were just living together as friends, and then they kind of developed feelings for each other. I thought that was interesting as well. You know, I mean,
The line that she reads, which I think is the sexiest passage ever written in a book, is that she writes about the woman, her now partner, Teresa Wiersen, I think you say it. She says, quote, "Often when I was doing my pre-workout warm-up on the treadmill, I couldn't help noticing one particular trainer, tan, tattooed, and muscular, stalking across the gym floor, knit cap pulled so low over his long brown hair that it nearly covered my eyes." And then she didn't realize later, until she was in the dressing room, that it was a woman.
Yeah.
And that was love at first sight. There you go.
You know, you said this is exactly what gays needed at for Halloween. And so should I assume what straights needed was a Bernie Sanders costume from the inauguration? Is that, have you seen this, by the way?
Yes, I have. It's the from a company called Dolls Kill. The Bernie Sanders famous, they're calling it the Once Again Asking costume set. Hi, it's Bernie Sanders. I'm once again asking you. And it's a picture of him.
That's very good.
It's a costume of him. Thank you. In the chair with the mittens, waiting for the inauguration to start, which I was talking about this today with Natalie Lizarraga on Current, that we did the inauguration together covering it, and we both saw him at the same time and went, oh my God, look at Bernie.
That's great.
So it's $85. We don't know if the chair is included with it or not. If the chair is, I'd be okay buying it. But what I just enjoy, you know, from a kind of sick standpoint, is listening to the progressives' heads explode. That, you know, this person who is emblematic of progressive politics, and the woman Jen Ellis, who did those mittens that they knitted out of recycled plastic, has now turned into a capitalist item in the billion-dollar industrial Halloween complex. You know that, Bernie, you could make this at home, Jim. You don't need.
I don't think he'd be upset by this. I think he played. Didn't he go on shows and make fun of himself after this?
Yeah.
He was great about it. I thought.
Yeah. Do they have a Bernie head to go with it, or what?
Well, no, you have a mask. You have a mask, and I'm sure
you have a good Bernie mask. Because otherwise, I don't know how you pull it off with just a winter coat and a pair of mittens.
His spokesperson, Mike Kaska, told Vice, "If fans of Senator Sanders' mittens are looking for a real scare this Halloween, they should see how hard the wealthy and world's biggest corporations are fighting to stop Congress from finally addressing the long neglected needs of the working class." I would add, Happy Halloween.
Okay, so one last thing, Sue, we wanted to talk to you about. I don't know if you had a chance to see Beth Tytel's column, which, of course, now I have lost.
That's good. Marjorie's thrown it away. Okay, good. I'm not going to bail you out, by the way.
Okay. I just want to read this. Beth Tytel is a really talented writer, and she's got a front-page story talking about you think the office, or what's left of it, is in chaos. HR, as in human resources, has it all figured out. So she's doing a takeoff.
Yeah, it's called – good. Yeah, it's a satire. It's called A Very Nice Correspondence from Human Resources, Re-Return to Office. And the first line, of course, is our chief heart officer will answer your questions as soon as her twins are out of quarantine. You know, it's a great gentle yeah. reminder that human resources doesn't work for the employees. Just as an FYI, human resources works for the corporation, right? The company you work for. And in this satirical memo, Beth notes in the chief heart officer is telling everyone that you will be returning to the office in 2043. Which yeah. seems like a long way off, but it's right around the corner. You know?
Well, hold on. Hold on. I think we to do it justice, we have to talk about it just as she wrote it, because these first couple of paragraphs are great. This is from the HR office. Dear colleagues, thank you for attending the company-wide Zoom and for your numerous questions in the wake of our updated return date announcement. We understand that 2043 does sound like a long way off, but we are pleased to let you know that we are targeting Q1, whatever that means.
First quarter.
Okay, thank you very much. Julia will answer your questions in greater detail at our next Zoom, which will be scheduled, as you said, Sue, as soon as Julia's twins are out of quarantine. And for those of you, Beth Teichel goes on, who have not met Julia, she's the new Dominique, who was the new Jada, who replaced Tom, who filled Arjun's shoes, who stepped in when Darius left in March, and who the hell can remember which March it was anymore.
Yeah.
So this is just something that people could get a big kick out of reading. It's on the front page of the Globe today. You can get it online, Beth Teitel, T-E-I-T-E-L-L. Do you think 2043 is too soon to come back to the office, Sue? What do you think?
Well, I've returned to the office. I've returned to NECN, and it's been very bizarre because there are people there I've never worked with. I don't know who they are. Thank God they have nameplates so I can pretend that I knew, or someone I met once. We're not returning. We don't have a plan to return to the office till January, but that's been pushed every month, since the spring. And when someone shows up, it's always funny when they haven't been there regularly because they're so happy to see everybody. And then you realize, well, it's kind of lonely, It's
kind of
like,
exactly.
It's like the rescue ship has come for you, but they've been traveling.
So we got to go. But to prepare for next week, if you could possibly go through the history of the last, 7 or 8 mayors of Revere for us on the air.
Exactly.
We'd really appreciate that. So get to work. And
how
we'll
many
talk
went
to
jail and how many didn't?
See you, Sue O'Connell.
I will.
Media
Goodbye.
Maven Sue O'Connell joins us every week. She's the co-publisher of Bay Windows and South End News and contributor to Current on NBC, LX, and NECN. Coming up, CNN's John King, because he couldn't make it on Tuesday, is here to talk all things politics today and Friday. Keep your dial on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brody and Marjorie Egan. As Marjorie said, we missed John on Tuesday because Maura Healey, the Attorney General, was here from 1 to 2. But joining us today to go over the latest political headlines is CNN's John King. John, of course, is their chief national correspondent and anchor of Inside Politics. Hello, John King.
Happy Friday.
And to you.
So, John King, I really love this story. For weeks and weeks and weeks, we've watched Pete watch people running around. I think it looks something like some gymnasium or something out in the middle of Arizona, checking allegations by former President Trump that it was a stolen election in Arizona. It's been going on like forever. So what has happened with the counting of the votes in Arizona?
Well, we get the full report in about 2.5-3 hours in Arizona. But the summary of the report, which our reporters have seen, get this, not only this is the report, as you know, Donald Trump said this would prove his big lie. This would prove him right. The election was stolen. This would prove it. Election was stolen in Arizona. Then we move on to other states. Well, the firm that was hired by Republicans, paid by Republicans, after 6 months and $6 million, has concluded Joe Biden won. And the quote-unquote audit actually says Joe Biden got more votes than Maricopa County gave him. So it went the other way, shall we say. It's funny. It is funny because it is lunacy, the fantasy of the big lie. But then it's not funny because this was an inspiration for January 6th. This is a continued inspiration for quote-unquote audits in Texas and Pennsylvania, and it is the inspiration for a lot of these changes in election laws that make it harder to vote, and it is a sham. It's a total sham. Joe Biden won, period.
So what is Donald Trump yet badmouth this firm that was going to deliver him from the wilderness, or has he said anything?
All he has said so far, my understanding, is that he's just don't believe the fake news reports. Wait until you actually see the audit. But again, our reporters have seen it. Reporters from other organizations have seen the summary, which says that Joe Biden won Maricopa County and therefore won Arizona. So I think to your point, Jim, I think that, you know, so what do you do if you're Donald Trump? You have two choices. One would be take this as a wake up call and drop it. Accept math, accept the truth, accept fairness, accept democracy. But you and I know that is not going to happen. So now he will undoubtedly attack the system and perhaps even attack the great cyber ninjas who shouldn't have been there in the first place.
So since you have a better feel on the ground of virtually anybody I know in our business about how real people react to things, is there one Trump voter who's going to say, that's what I was hanging my hat on? One Trump big lie believer who's going to say, I've had enough, I'm moving on? Or is this going to affect nobody, like almost every negative story about the lies of Donald Trump do affect nobody?
I think you raise a key question, Jim, and I hope more Republicans stand up. And any Republican who has been skeptical or said at least let this play out, again, it's lunacy. But if that's where you were, well, find your way back to the truth. Find your way back to reason. Find your way to forgiveness, if you will. But I wouldn't count on it in the sense that, unfortunately, this has been said so many times. And again, it's not just Arizona. This is the roots of the big lie. The big lie is cancer, and it's toxic, not just about Trump and Biden,
yes,
but about faith in our institutions and faith in our democracy, faith in the most basic work of our democracy. And the roots now are everywhere in these 14 or 15 states that have already changed their election laws. In Republicans who continue to believe Democrats cheated. So I hope that more Republicans now will say it's time to let this go. And not only is it time to let it go, it's time to say it was a dangerous fantasy and a fraud on the American people, on the Republican voters. It was a fraud on people who support Trump more than it was a fraud on anybody.
We're talking to John King.
So, John King, we talked about this during the week with our listeners, that many of us are getting a little depressed because it seems as though the Biden agenda is stalled, and a lot of things he wants to do in these two bills, infrastructure, let's call them number one and number two, may not get anywhere. He thinks they still can. What does the smart money say in D.C.?
The smart money here, let me try it this way. The smart money, this is John King from Dorchester, John King, former bartender, not John King, political reporter.
Okay.
The smart money would say everybody should enjoy their weekend. If you prefer an adult beverage, have one or two. Hope the Red Sox take at least two out of three from the Yankees and come back on Monday. Because this is all going to come to a head next week. The speaker said again today they're going to bring up that bipartisan immigration bill. She promised the moderates the vote would be Monday, and she says she's going to keep that promise. And she says stay tuned as to when the bigger, they call it reconciliation, that's the budget speaker in Washington, the bigger package will be ready. Look, this is high drama. This is an all-or-nothing moment for the Biden agenda, and there's every reason for Democrats to be anxious about this. It's never been done before, right? It's never been done before. Democrats believe in the end, party unity will prevail and everybody will compromise. Those who want $3.5 trillion are going to have to compromise. Those who say they only want $1 trillion are going to have to compromise. They believe by the end of next week, we'll all be looking back and saying, wow, they did it. But think about it. Any one of the pieces, just in the reconciliation bill, more child tax credits, elder care, free pre-K, free community college, health care changes, either to Medicare or Obamacare, a big climate package, any one piece of that would be a giant achievement, accomplishment, and a very complicated debate in Washington. Put, you know, everything into this one bill because they have to, because they get no Republican support. So it is high drama on steroids times a thousand. But push has to come to shove soon, and that's next week.
You know, this may be an unfair question and maybe too in the weeds. Nancy Pelosi is obviously a brilliant legislator, and her ability to salvage things that appear unsalvageable is epic. But I've thought a lot about this, is how do you please the moderates and the progressives in that? Forget the mansions and the cinemas and things in the Senate, in the House. How do you please both sides? And I have to say, I can't come up with anything that passes the laugh test. Do you, without going into great detail, can you in your head, John, as somebody who's been following this for decades, can you craft something that allows her to satisfy both critical elements here?
You're not going to fully satisfy anybody, Jim, because, again, these progressives have been waiting a long time, and they have a big, bold, ambitious agenda that costs a lot of money and that rewrites the way that government interacts in your life, that rewrites the social safety net. The moderates say, look, I come from a different place. I don't live in Boston or New York City or San Francisco, and I can't vote for that and get reelected. And so they have to all compromise. Here's the only way to do it. I'm not smart enough to put the pieces of it together. But here's the thing. I can't do the policy piece, right? How much can you do on climate? Where do you have to compromise? But I think here's the speaker's message, and this has to be the president's message. Even if it's $2 trillion, it will be the biggest thing done since Lyndon Johnson was president. It will be, yes, it's only a down payment on where we want to go, but why don't we make that down payment and then prove to the American people that this works? Yeah. Prove to the American people that we're going to raise taxes on the rich and the middle class are not going to pay for this. And then we can come back in the next election or the one after that and say, see what we did? Trust me. Now we need to do more. That's the only argument the Democrats have. And an ultra-liberal Democrat is not going to be happy, nor is a moderate who's probably going to have to vote for a bigger package than he or she wants. The only thing the Democrats can sell is that if we pass nothing, we all lose next year. If we got elected saying we were going to govern responsibly and competently and deal with all these issues and we do nothing, well, then the Republicans will run the House and the Senate next after the elections next year. Joe Biden will be a lame duck and we will have nothing as opposed to at least a decent peace.
So you actually think that by the end of next week, by sometime next week, we'll have a sense what the fate of the trillion-dollar bipartisan and the 3.5 Democrats-only measures, what their fate is likely to be?
Yes, I think we will know. And I don't know which way it's going to turn out. I can tell you where all the pressure on the Democratic Party is cut a deal. But again, no one has done anything of this size and scope. This is like, this is Joe Biden's version of the New Deal. And, it's not exactly FDR. It's not exactly LBJ. But LBJ did a lot of it in pieces, too. The Democrats are trying to do this all in one big piece. And nobody involved, for all the deal-making skills of Nancy Pelosi, for all the deal-making skills on the Senate experience and vice presidential experience of Joe Biden, for all these chairmen involved, Jim McGovern of Massachusetts is the Rules Committee chairman. He has to be a magician in the next several days here. None of them have ever done this. And so the question is, can they? And we're going to find out next week.
So, John, you were aware that for reasons we'll make clear in a second, we had to cut short today's discussion. You're part of the reason. And we really thank you for your time, and we'll discuss things more fully on Tuesday. Thanks so much, and have a great weekend.
Take care, guys.
Thank you, John.
John King joins us every week. He's CNN's chief national correspondent and anchor of Inside Politics. John King, thank you very much for being here. Okay, normally we'd be going to a talker right now and opening the lines, but the woman who's run our show for the last 8 years since we got hired here is leaving.
She's going to love
this.
This
is,
by the
of
way.
Course, all Jim's fault.
Not.
Our regular guests agree it is, and we're going to hear from them and from you. Our thanks for making from them. And from us, that is, for making us all look smarter, more clever, and even better looking than we actually are. Special tribute to Chelsea Moore's up next.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. I think I can sum this up in two words. Three, we are screwed. Chelsea Murs, and you've heard her name nonstop through the years. You don't hear her voice much, who has run this show brilliantly, to say the least, for all the time we've been here, is leaving Boston Public Radio. And as you've heard us say in the past, but I think it's Murth saying again, Marjorie, the smartest, most creative, hardest working person I have ever shared a workplace with, and she is going to be missed in an incredible way. And we decided today to spend a few minutes having people who have worked with her share their thoughts on her departure. So the next few minutes in the show, you're going to hear from a ton of voices you know, I guess, for lack of a better expression, paying a tribute to Chelsea. And if you don't know Chelsea, there are no words to describe how much she's going to hate every single second of this, because there's no, she's nodding. There's nothing she hates more than people heaping praise on anything she does. Is that a fair statement,
Marjorie?
That's
a fair statement, but it's too bad because we're doing it.
We are doing it. So here's the deal. We're going to play a group of people, several groups of people, who have a few things or wanted to say a few things about Chelsea. The first one actually includes John King. These are some regulars who we're quite fond of.
Chelsea, hi. This is Alex Beam. You know, my shining memory of you will always be me sitting behind a guest microphone at the Boston Public Library in the new cafe, and I'm spouting these incredible bon mots and witticisms to Jim and Marjorie. And 12 feet across from me, I see you on your laptop playing solitaire, totally ignoring what's going on, paying your bills, your head bowed down. You couldn't be less interested in what I was saying. But right above your head, I see a thought balloon, a vivid thought balloon. And the thought balloon is, who booked this idiot? The answer, Chelsea, is you booked this idiot. Thank you so much for all your great contributions. I'm going to miss you. Godspeed.
Hi, Chelsea. I am so sorry to see you go. As you know, I think you are a fantastic human being and a producer extraordinaire. It's amazing to me that more than 6 years have passed since I did my first Boston Public Radio. And again, as I've said to you many times, I marvel at your ability to put that show together. 4 days a week, 3 hours of live radio is no small thing, but I just wanted to make sure that you heard from me how extraordinary a person I think you are, and know that I wish you nothing but the best in everything you do going forward. Don't forget us all when you're rich and famous, and know that you made my experience in radio so much better. Thank you.
It's Corby Kummer, whose every minute for the past, I don't want to think how many years, has been marked by Chelsea Murr's love, in fact, adoration and worship. If there was a want ad for someone to run my life, everyone who placed it would pray that Chelsea Murr's answered it. There's nothing she can't do better than you can, or with more grace, or with more unflappability, calm, lovely, gracious, good manners, and incredible skill and competence at writing, at picking the best articles to discuss, at putting together the best group of guests that makes everyone in Boston need and want to listen to Boston Public Radio. And those of us who get to participate look forward and have the most fun of our entire week. Of course, there's Jim and Marjorie, but all of us feel that we won't really be able to get up in the morning without knowing Chelsea is there. So, Chelsea, we're going to miss you terribly. We wish you well, and we wish you in our lives at all times.
Hey, Chelsea, it's Juliette Kayyem. I am excited for you, but I have to be sad for me. For several years now, you have been part of my weekly existence. For those who listen to this show every Tuesday, Chelsea and I work through an agenda. But given what I talk about, national security and homeland security issues, there's a flurry of emails every Wednesday morning before I go on live to adapt to the breaking news. And throughout it, Chelsea has been a guiding hand to make the conversation on air seem natural and fluid and spontaneous and fun, despite what we're talking about and all the hard issues we've been talking about. So Chelsea, I just want to thank you for the three C's, for your name, for being calm and cool and compassionate to me and to the team, but also I think most importantly to the viewers who have come to adore and love and depend on the show. And that is not, don't tell them, because of Jim and Marjorie. That is because of its leadership in you. So good luck with everything, and we'll miss you.
Hey, Chelsea, John King from CNN. More importantly, John King from Dorchester. I just wanted to say thank you and farewell and wish you the best. I know what it's like to put a live broadcast on the air, so I know how grateful Jim and Marjorie are to you for your grace, for your kindness, for your patience, for your humility, for your air traffic control skills, for your chaos skills. I want to thank you for your kindness to me every Tuesday and wish you the best as you head off into this new adventure. Can't wait to see you coming out of the bullpen for the Red Sox in October. Take care.
Chelsea looks like she's really enjoying this.
I am really enjoying it, whether she is or not.
I just want to say, you know, yeah. I worked for the Boston Herald for 35 years. Yeah. I quit. No, thank you.
They canceled your health insurance.
They canceled my health insurance. Yeah. Was it something? Did I do something wrong, Jim?
I think it was. And by the way, if people think at the end of these Chelsea's going to say something, don't hold your breath. You don't know Chelsea Merz. And by the way, we brought your regulars. Here's another group of regulars, actually with a GBH alum thrown right in the middle.
Hey, Chelsea. It's Cy Montgomery. And I have just so loved corresponding with you about all this animal news, from rats who drive little cars to de-stress, to gay dad penguins, and koalas with chlamydia, and of course, octopuses, and for loving my dancing dog. I have been so grateful to work with you. You have always made me seem like I've got a clue, even when I'm being totally clueless. So I want to thank you for loving and respecting animals. I want to thank you for always being so warm and so knowledgeable and so helpful and encouraging and fun. From the moment you welcomed me into the WGBH Jim and Marjorie show family, and anytime you are hankering after a hickey from an octopus, remember I'm here to help. So I really hope you stay in touch.
So Chelsea is leaving. And what does that mean, listeners? It is horrible. It is terrible. Let me give some examples by behind the scenes things that she's done for me. My Zoom's not working. What are we going to do? Can you solve it? My dog is barking or sick or something. Can you help me by delaying my recording? The phone won't work. We had a big storm. I'm sick. Can we do it later? I'm going to be in some remote location. Could we do it from there, even though the place barely has electricity? Jim and Marjorie want this included at the last minute. Can you help me understand what it is that they want? Chelsea, you've been an angel of stability behind the scenes in an ocean or a sea of flux. You're really going to be missed.
Hey, Chelsea, it is Trenny. I was counting the ways today of all of the ways we are going to miss you. And here's what I came up with. 22,876 printed pages of paper for Jim, 197 COVID Zoom links, 1,652 soups, salads, and sandwiches for Marjorie at the public library, endless hours of patience, most of all dealing with all of us who appear on Boston Public Radio. But honestly, Chelsea, it was an absolute joy to work with you and to get to know you. The last, I don't even know how many years it's been since I've been doing this show. 3, 5, whatever it is, time flies when you love what you do. Thank you for making it easy and fun every single time I've been on the show, even when I'm calling in from Wisconsin with barking German shepherds and a lawn mowing dad. No one does it better than you, and I'm not sure how we're going to do it without you.
Chelsea Merz, the ultimate radio producer, and the key to this show and others before it. You're the best kept secret in radio land, Chelsea, the best backup singer in showbiz, 20 feet from stardom and all that. And absolutely indispensable. You know the news, the novels, the names and phone numbers of anybody interesting in this world. You dig the deepest. You've got the best taste and the best friends out there. Have you told Jim and Marjorie that they're going to have to work a whole lot harder? It's time for you and me, Chelsea, to have a martini again. Here's to you, with lots of love from Christopher Lydon.
Chelsea, this is Brian Landry, and I just got the word that you're leaving for greener, bluer, or oranger pastures. And all I can say is, don't do it, kid. I'm going to miss you too much. And I'd really be sad right now, but I've got a hooker coming over in 15 minutes, and I've got a sparkle. So all I can say is, best of luck. I love you.
Okay. We're getting some play from our listeners as well, Jim. Robert just emailed and said, Chelsea, Jim would be nothing but the GBH mail clerk without you. And John says, cherished Chelsea, of course, because she can deal with one James Spencer Browdy. Who are you possibly going to recruit
who will have to contend with him?
By the way, we've thought about every one of those things, and we have no answers. Here's yet some more regulars led by the Revs.
Hey there, Chelsea. This is Reverend Irene Monroe. Girl, I'm going to miss you. There are no words that will capture the enormity of your leaving. You have been a steadfast supporter and cheerleader of All Revved Up, the segment and the podcast, and I can't thank you enough. But I'm going to miss our Sunday morning email exchanges, you always wishing Emmett and me a good segment, and asking me if I got in my daily Fitbit steps. A tsunami of thanks would neither aptly nor amply convey my heartfelt gratitude, girlfriend. I don't just thank you, Chelsea, for the help you gave me in having a public voice, but I also thank you for the type of person you walk in the world as that comes through in your work. The wonderment of life is often time for brief moments when you hear a song or a sermon, see a picture or meet a person who enriches your life. And for me, one of those moments was when our paths crossed. I thank you. God bless you. Take precious care. And I send you a virtual hug.
Hey, Chelsea, Reverend Emmett Price here of All Revved Up. I just need to say thank you for your unwavering support, your exuberant encouragement, and your tremendous professionalism with a nonstop work ethic. What listeners should know about you is that you produce the way a Michelin or James Beard award-winning chef takes fantastic raw ingredients and puts it together to make a masterpiece of a plate. Thank you, Chelsea, and best wishes to you in all of your forward progress.
Hey, Chelsea, Paul Revel here. Chelsea invited me to be a guest on BPR many years ago and thousands of emails ago. For that, I'll always be grateful. From the standpoint of a regular guest on BPR, Chelsea, you were the best. Gracious, smart, supportive, considerate, and just a positive, thoughtful, enthusiastic partner. You always made me feel welcome and appreciated. You were accommodating and helpful in solving logistical problems, while open-minded and savvy about setting our agenda for on-air discussions. You were great on follow-up, all the details, and making me feel like every appearance was worthwhile. I seldom saw you in person over all these years, but I always felt you were a real friend and an ideal colleague. I'll certainly miss you a lot, and I feel badly for Jim and Marjorie because I know what a tough act you are to follow. I wish you all the best in your next chapter. Thank you so much, Chelsea.
I'm Rick Steves, and I've just got something from my heart I want to share about working with Chelsea. Hey, Chelsea, I just learned that you are moving along, and I wanted to thank you for being the hero behind the scenes. Of course, everybody loves Jim and Marjorie's show, but as a return guest over the last 6 months, I know very well that you hung it together, you stayed up late, you connected with me and communicated so well, and every time I was on the air with Jim and Marjorie, I was aware that that show is great because of the hard and professional work of Chelsea behind the scenes. Thanks for being my special friend as I've enjoyed a beautiful season on Jim and Marjorie's show, and best wishes in whatever's next with you and your career. Thanks again, and happy travels.
Chelsea, it's Michael Curry. I want to say congratulations. I want to say thank you for your service at GBH. I've had a chance to work with you for quite a while now. I've been a guest on segments that you've been the executive producer on, and I can tell you I've enjoyed every interaction. I've appreciated your invitation to join in this discussion that you get to produce on a weekly basis. And I'm honored, I'm humbled, and I'm so thankful that you and I became friends through this work. So I want to say congratulations, and I got you back.
Hey, Chelsea, it's Sue O'Connell. I know everyone is probably talking about what an amazing human being you are, but I want to highlight that you are one of the few individuals in my life who can keep jokes running at least over a period of 10 years. We have had a joke about a coffee stain at GBH. We have had a joke about the Memory Palace guests that we had on the Callie Crossley show when you so generously booked me on the show and let me be the co-host. And we have had an ongoing joke about the grinder at the Whole Foods for fresh peanut butter. So I wish you the best of luck, as you can imagine, but I'm also hoping that we can keep these jokes going for at least another two or three decades. Good luck, Chelsea.
Okay, Renee is emailing. She says, I miss you already, Chelsea. I don't even know you. But Devin, who is an intern here, Chelsea, she's just written in to say she is devastated to hear that you're leaving. And she goes on and on about what a great boss you were and how much you taught her here at GBH. She's going to send you a personal goodbye, but she wants to let you know the impact she had on you working at GBH.
By the way, Chelsea's mask has gone up further and further, so we can see even less of her face in reaction. So you're probably saying, how about some of her fellow GBHers? Where are they? Well, here they are.
Chelsea Mers, Brian O'Donovan here. What can I say? You are such the professional, always, always toiling behind the scenes with research and scripts and facts and quotes and, well, just the best instincts. Jim and Marjorie, I know you'd agree. Chelsea is so the secret sauce, the magic formula that has ye sounding so informed and erudite and well-read. Chelsea, it's our collective, GBH loss, and I include our audience in that. Thank you and good luck.
Hey, Chelsea, Emily here. Well, what a run you've had and what a significant and impressive imprint you've left at GBH. I actually remember the day I met you sitting in a conference room with Phil Rado. He was explaining how our radio shows were going to work. And as I recall, it took a little convincing for you to get on board. And that's just one of the things I admire about you. Your skepticism, not to mention your graciousness, your sassy knack with the written word, and your unparalleled organizational skills. Chelsea, it's been a pleasure getting to know you over the years. And, hey, I've been meaning to ask, did you actually make that delicious, creamy, chocolatey, gooey thing that you used to pass out for Christmas? If so, send recipe. Chelsea, I'm wishing you much future success.
Chelsea, you are the producer extraordinaire. I lucked out when you agreed to be the inaugural producer for the Callie Crossley Show back in 2010. I was the beneficiary of your vast audio experience and your seemingly never-ending source of creative production ideas. You guided our scrappy team masterfully, and we had a lot of fun. So glad we were able to continue working together after you went to work for Boston Public Radio. I remain in awe of your gifts, including sharp intellect and exquisite writing, and I'll miss your quick wit and sly humor. You have given much during your time at GBH. I hope for you whatever great opportunity awaits in your next chapter. Callie.
Hey, Chelsea, it's Jared Bowen. Close your ears. I know you hate people talking about you, but here goes. So Chelsea is the wind beneath everyone's wings. I have to totally employ that cliche, even though I love that song, to talk about her, because she is far too clever, far too original, and far too genius for most of us to keep pace. Chelsea is not just the ally you want in the foxhole. I know, another cliche. She's the drinking buddy you need to remain calm. She's the comedian you want for the conflict to pass swiftly. And she's the one who, armed only with an orange peel and a hair clip, will craft an armored escape vehicle to get you out of the foxhole. And you won't question how she did it. You just smile, knowing it was inevitable that she would.
Okay, Elizabeth just emailed, said she used to like us on our old radio station, Jim, but Chelsea really classed us up. Who knew they could clean up, so we'll have them made respectable members of the community. She gives all the thanks and credit to Chelsea.
Do you think Chelsea's spending all this time figuring out what she's going to say? Not. That won't be happening, trust me. In any case, hey, Jim and Marjorie, how about the BPR team members? Well, we didn't have time for all of them, but here are a few.
Chelsea, hello. It's Aiden. I think we both share a discomfort with the overly sentimental, so I'll keep this brief. You are an excellent boss and a wonderful person, and we're really still figuring out how we're going to operate without you. Thank you so much for everything you brought to this show. It really was a whole lot. And as long as I've known you, you've ended every single email with cheers, so I'll do the same here. Cheers, Chelsea.
Hey, Chelsea. It's Zoe. I just want to say how much I'll miss your steady presence in the control room. When the 11 o'clock news hits, we buckle in for another three-hour roller coaster, exchange glances, and think, well, here we go. Thanks for making the ride a good one.
Hey, Chelsea, it's John the Claw. I hate that I'm not here today, but I'm really grateful that I was asked to participate, but not as grateful as I am to have been able to be part of your amazing crew. It has been a highlight that can never be equaled. You have been an amazing teacher, leader, and most importantly, friend. Thank you so much for everything, especially the best nickname in the world. Merci beaucoup. Au revoir. Bonjour. See you Monday.
Okay, don't worry, Chelsea. This is almost over.
I'm getting misty, by the way, from our coworkers. That was a little tough for me to handle here. So we are drawing this to a close. And by the way, Chelsea has been with, well, actually, we've been with her since the beginning. So this is really a big deal. And we're going to, the final tributes, because they haven't been included so far, a couple of regulars we have on the show who by day work for the Boston Globe. Here they are.
Hi, this is Shirley Leung from the Globe. BPR insiders know the show is really called the Jim, Marjorie, and Chelsea Show. Chelsea is the secret sauce. She's the X factor. She's the Oz operating the GBH transmitter atop of the Great Blue Hill. I honestly don't know what's going to happen Monday when Chelsea's gone. I mean, when I hear Jim or Marjorie with a clever turn of phrase, I know it's Chelsea's handiwork. I mean, she has an incredible way with words. As a regular contributor to BPR, I felt that Chelsea saw me. I mean, she has this knack of knowing what topics I wanted to talk about every week. And that is also what makes Jim and Marjorie's show so special. Just that innate sense of what the show is and isn't. Chelsea, I'm going to miss you tremendously, and I hope our paths cross again.
Hi, Chelsea. It's Christopher Muther. We're all so sad you're leaving, but especially me. In addition to all the great guidance you've given me over the years, one of the best things you've done is consoled me after Jim has verbally abused me on each segment. Not Marjorie, just Jim. So congratulations on moving past Jim Browdy. So I want to say that I completely understand why you would leave, but please don't leave me in the hands of Jim.
Hey there, Chelsea. Brian McGorry from the Boston Globe here. Anyone who knows even the slightest bit about this business knows that the success of a show is almost always a product of the people behind the scenes as much as the people behind the microphones. You've been making Jim and Marjorie look great for a long, long time, and Lord knows, specifically with one of them, it hasn't always been easy. And you've done it always with grace and humanity, even under withering pressure. Those of us who won't get your calls and emails, always smart and always so personal, are looking for a silver lining in all of this, and it's not easy to find one. But there is this. You get to wake up tomorrow and say the words you've been dreaming of for way too much of your career. Jim Browdy is not my problem anymore. Congratulations on a phenomenal run. You've had more impact on more lives than you might ever dare imagine. Take care, Chelsea.
Okay, alas, Jim Browdy is still my problem, as I said before. This is mostly Jim's fault, but maybe in fairness, I didn't tell Chelsea enough how much she means to me, how much I love her, how much I'm going to miss her. And like Jim said before, we are really screwed now.
You know, a number of the people, by the way, thank you, all those people. And there were many more who wanted to do this. We just didn't have time to pull it together. A couple of people referred lovingly to Chelsea as executive producer. You notice neither of us have used those words because there is really no title that describes the force that Chelsea has been behind the show. I hope people don't think this is hyperbole. We have never done anything like this before. We'll probably never do it again, but there has never been anybody like her. So we just want to thank her for everything she's done. There's never, if there was a scale, Marjorie, to measure someone's, what's the word I'm trying to think about how she feels
importance,
right now? No. How do you think she feels about this half hour of tribute?
I think she's really ticked off.
She's really ticked off, yeah. There's no, that's not, and she doesn't want to talk to you. But she thanks you, too, and we thank her for absolutely everything. Chelsea, you've been great, and we'll miss you every single minute. Lots of luck in the future.
Okay. Thank you all for tuning in to another edition of Boston Public Radio. On Monday, we're going to be joined by the Reverend Irene Monroe and the poet Richard Blanco, and, of course, Emmett Price will be with her. We want to thank our crew, Zoe Matthews, Aidan Conley, Mackenzie Farkas, Rebecca Taubor. Our engineer today is Bill Piccitelli. John the Claw Parker's not here. And, of course, we want to thank the irreplaceable Chelsea Murs. I'm Marjorie Egan.
Well, I want to say one thing quickly. I'm doing an event this afternoon at 4 o'clock as part of the Globe Summit with four Spotlight team members who, obviously, it's the 50th anniversary of the Spotlight thing. If you go to the Globe webpage and click on Globe Summit, you can join us 4 o'clock. Chelsea, again, miss you every single minute. You guys, we'll see you on Monday. Be well.